3, 2, 1, go. And
then
introduces
my guest. All right. Welcome, Max Tirico.
Welcome. Thank you. And thank you, Matt Newell. Or if we want to be more formal, Matt N. Hello. I'm Matt S.
Oh, yes. You're, and I'm Matt N.
Yes.
So, yeah, we know each other from our user group.
Yes.
For many years.
A couple of decades, actually, yes.
Yeah. So, sorry about the delay on the Technocrat Live. We weren't that live. We had a few technical difficulties. Our computer threw a hissy fit, but we're here now. So thanks for hanging in there, and let's get started. So how was your commute in? Was it okay? Or?
It was nice. I mean, today was a nice day anyway, right? It was nice to drive without any traffic.
Wait, you mean it wasn't 40 degrees and raining?
Disappointingly, it was not that kind of a day today, right?
Yeah.
So, no, it was a good, easy drive to get here. A very familiar place coming out to the Digital Ballpark, nice to be in this.
Right, that's where our user group meets.
Yes, it's good. Great folks here.
Yeah. Yep. So, it was... It's been pretty crazy. There's a meme going around about, like, hey, look, it stopped raining. It's time to cut the lawn. And, like, you know, they're in a jungle or something here.
Right.
I thought that was perfect.
My house is getting that way, actually.
Yeah. I was like, prepare for the show, mow the lawn. Yeah. Oh, well, I guess it's happening to the neighbors, too, so what can they do?
That's right. So, anyway, it was good. How did you come out here? Do you still ride motorcycle, by the way?
I do. Yeah. Very rarely, because the thing is, most of the time when I'm going someplace, I'm either carrying a load of stuff or I've got people with me. I've got my family with me.
Right.
And so I'm ferrying them here and there and everywhere.
Yeah.
And like it doesn't really, you know, errands don't make sense on motorcycles.
Yeah.
Medium commutes make sense. Mm. Long hauls make sense. Short mid hauls make sense. But short haul kind of, you know, station running doesn't really work.
Right.
So
because I'm actually driving here saying, boy, Matt N's got a nice day to ride on his bike if he's riding out to the
So, I would, actually coming to the show would be perfect, and I've been meaning to come, but my garage is in total chaos.
Oh.
So, I just got a bunch of big deliveries, and I'm like, it wasn't worth digging it out. But yes, probably in the next few shows I will ride in.
Awesome, good.
I'll make sure to show off the helmet.
Right, drive the bike right into the show if you want. You know,
yeah. it'll be a prop. Yeah. People are like, what show am I watching? This is the Technocrat Live.
Yeah.
We'll hack into its computer and tune it, and then you'll be like, oh, okay.
Now I get it. Right.
I have this really great. So I mentioned in the last show, and I'll mention it again because now I've got my hands on it and it actually works. Kind of. I haven't done all the tests yet, so I'm not satisfied. But I've actually got this great electrical generator from a company called Ego, and they sell them at Home Depot.
Huh.
So they're one of the battery-powered power tools, yard tools in Home Depot. And I'm not pitching for them.
Right.
But, I mean, it's a lot of promise. You can take 4 lithium-ion batteries, so 7.5 amp-hour batteries, and put it on a unit and power 3,000 watts peak. So and it's pure sine wave for the people who are into inverters and know what that means.
Right,
so that basically means you can run anything on it, it's not just whatever junk. So I actually picked it up and I'm really psyched about it. I may bring it in for show and tell. Sorry I missed this one, but if you're interested, leave something in the comments and I'll lug the thing in here. It is substantial. It's the size of a generator.
Very nice.
So I have some news, so I hope you don't mind.
Do the news, man.
All right, so there's actually, you'd probably be interested in this too.
Mm.
I held off on telling Matt about this because there might be some reactions. So I don't know if you're a Firefox user, but there was a thing with Firefox, and I've been talking on the show about Web 2.5 and Web 2.0, Web 2.5, and Web 3.0.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is I'm using these terms consistently, maybe differently than other people, but I found that other people are more chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And I really needed to nail this down. I may make a cartoon at some point. So Web 2.0 is basically the walled garden, Facebook, Twitter.
Right.
All your data is locked in with this vendor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to keep your followers, if you want to keep your posts, if you want to keep all that stuff, you got to go to that vendor, and then they provide it for you under their terms.
Right.
And so Web 2.5 is kind of Kilroy. It's peeping over the wall. It's reaching over the using some mechanism to reach over the wall and pluck some of that data out and put it on the outside so you can see it there too.
Mm-hmm.
And then Web 3.0 is basically public metadata in a completely open source fashion, everywhere and open. And not just uncensorable, but also uninterruptible, like the rest of the internet, the internet was meant to be.
Sure, sure.
So, that fire. Let me go back to Firefox. Mm. Firefox broke, and the cert broke.
Yes.
I wanted to mention this in the last show, and I actually forgot. Sorry about that. What happened was you'd be using Firefox, and if you had any add-ons, even some of the officially blessed add-ons from Firefox, mm-hmm. they just broke. All of them broke all of a sudden.
Yes.
It turns out it was a cert problem. They didn't assign a cert, which, of course, you know, cert signatures are very quick to fix.
Absolutely.
You know, you know what's wrong. You know, maybe an hour if there's a really convoluted process. Mm-hmm. It took them half a day to fix it. Mm. So I was a little suspicious that it was a trial balloon to try to stop Web 2.5 because there's a ton of different clients out there, Web 2.5 clients that are Kilroying, and the way they do it is they use your browser to peek in over the wall into whatever walled gardens. Mm. The most popular one is, at least now I found three vendors, and this is all pretty recently, of Web 2.5 clients that will, whenever you go like on Amazon or Walmart or any kind of shopping site, they'll actually use the product data from the shopping site, scan all the other sites on the web, and tell if you're getting the best price.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using it in a very commerce-oriented way, and it's going to be a really hard argument. I mean, because they're making money on this, it's going to be a really hard argument to argue that they're doing something wrong.
Right.
But the same technique can be used to, like, pluck your tweets out or whatever.
True.
And that was very suspicious what happened with Firefox. They did fix it, and it's fine now. So, someone had actually mentioned in the user group meeting, like, well, who cares? You know, like, it's everyone's just Firefox or Chrome anyway. Yes, but it's a fork of Firefox or Chrome. Uh-huh. So if they make a decision you don't like, you have your own fork. And that's how open source works.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So I have noticed, and just to give you a quick example of Web 2.5, I know a lot of people think that Gab is political, and it definitely is, but it's not always the same politics, and that's the mistake that they're making. So one of the things that's interesting about Gab is they have a Web 2.5 client called Dissenter, and it just sits in your browser, and when you go to different pages, it actually comes up with a little indicator saying, hey, someone's made a comment on this page. Mm. So when it first came out, it was like it was just a proof of concept, but it's been out for a few months now, I'm starting to see those little comment markers on a lot of pages. So if you have any interest in any kind of web comment content whatsoever, regardless of whether you like Gab or not, you probably want to sign up for an account and start looking at the sites that you care about to see if anyone's put comments on Dissenter. They're on their own network, and you know, like, if you don't, because otherwise you don't know what people are saying about your site.
Right.
You know, regardless of what you think about, you know, and a lot of it's been positive, but not all of it. Some of it's been highly negative. So something we might look into.
Good.
So I don't know. Did you hear about the Hui ban? Is that how you? Howie? Huawei ban. They're a hardware manufacturer. Hawaii.
Huawei. Okay. Not to be confused with Wawa.
That is not how I would spell Huawei. I believe you.
It's Chinese.
That's funny. I was pitching this show. I actually advertised this show as being, you know, not knowing how to pronounce something just means you know how to read.
Yes.
That was my joke for the show. And it actually came true. It only took 8 minutes for it to come true.
I'll give yourself credit.
855. All right. There you go. All right.
Yeah, good work there.
So,
no, I'm not aware of that. No.
Yeah. So Trump just signed it into law. I don't think it was his baby. I think it was someone else's. But basically banning companies from using their hardware because there's some kind of backdoor issue. So I don't know anything else about it.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on with that. But this actually could be really significant if you've had a major hardware investment.
Absolutely.
At first when I read it, I'm like, oh, this must be government agencies, right? Mm. There must be an edict, like the DOE can't use this because it's too dangerous. Mm. No, it was for American companies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've gotten to the point now where backdooring is manufacturer backdoors is enough of an issue that we're willing to interrupt commerce for military security. This is a big deal, people. This has not happened before.
Right.
So, if you think everything's peachy and hunky-dory with China, maybe not.
Well,
Yeah.
Right. We always have to be a little cautious about these things. And
right. There's been a few backdoors found in the past, but they never did a ban. You know, usually the market just sorted it out and went, oh, okay.
Right.
But these guys are really huge and they dominate. So if you see a sale in Micro Center, check the manufacturer's name on the motherboard before you. Oh, what a deal!
If the price is too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah. So there's also a bug in Intel chips, so if you haven't heard about this, called zombie load. This is a read random memory segments bug. So it's pretty severe.
Yep.
So it might be time to update your operating system. There was patches on Debian, I'm assuming they were related to it, because the timing seemed right. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually get to go in there and read the errata, but...
Yeah. Right.
And finally, and this goes back into what I was talking about with Web 2.5, we have our first web major player with a Web 3.0 application.
All right.
Metadata on the uncensorable, unmutable, peer-to-peer web.
Right.
From the get-go.
Wow.
And guess what company it is?
I actually don't know.
You don't know? You didn't cheat and look at the notes?
I didn't look. I wanted to be fair.
Microsoft.
Get out. Is that right? No way.
It's a thing called Ion, and it's going to, you can use it for logins, like you use a Facebook login or a Google login or whatever, and it's on the blockchain. It's on a blockchain.
Wow.
So is that crazy or what? They're the freaking good guys, man.
Yeah, well, we got to investigate this a little more because I don't know.
And there's an open certification. There's a WW3 certification.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Microsoft, somebody, I don't know if it was Microsoft or somebody, was complaining that Facebook wasn't really playing nice.
Oh.
Surprise, surprise, because they're like the Web 2.0 juggernaut. You know, their walled gardens have the highest walls.
Right. So they've got the most to lose.
Yeah, they got the most to lose, and they're like, yeah, we love this idea. This is great. We're going to help.
Oh.
I'm helping push the car. I'm helping push the car. We're going to really, they're not really helping. So, but yeah, go Microsoft. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because we have an inside joke in our user group about Microsoft and other technologies, right, that aren't open source. But, you know, in my company, we actually use Microsoft Azure as our hosting provider, and we put more and more in there, and, you know, we all could be skeptical about that. Those of us who are, who think Microsoft is still the evil company out out west. But, we use it, and day to day, night to night, you know, it's working.
How responsive are they to, like, customer service requests? And
interesting. There actually was a fairly major outage about a week ago that affected us. It affected the...
We never have outages here on Technocrat Live.
Not outages.
He's laughing.
At all.
Crap happens, it's fine.
It's just a delayed start. It's different than an outage.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you haven't started yet, so you're not out.
Trying to do something. It's fine. It's okay. I'm just surprising him.
Steve's a pioneer.
I asked him to do something new, so it's my fault.
No, he's a pioneer. You gotta take the chance. But at Azure, actually, there was a problem with DNS caching, and that affected a lot of their SQL Server instances. So the side of our company that uses the Microsoft technology, our product, everything went down. But of course, if you go to the Microsoft Azure status site, they're a little slow about changing those little green check marks to red flags. So,
right.
But it was a fairly major outage that affected several regions for several hours. So
were they giving you guys constant updates about what was going on and what the state of things were?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did they give you an ETA that was accurate? Or
By the time they posted ETAs, the services were starting to come back. But again, this is still.
Did they have a strategy that would have beaten this? Like a multi-region strategy that if had you used it, you would have been safe?
You know, we have a multi-region strategy, and apparently it was an update. You know, engineers have to do updates sometime during the day, and the update, their process failed, from what I understand. So, so there's somebody, red-faced, sitting in an office somewhere in the world who is getting a talking to.
Right, so we've actually, this kind of brings me into something I wanted to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. So, are you familiar with site reliability engineering?
A bit, yeah.
Yeah, so we had our current secretary actually did a great talk on it. There's a Technocrat Live where he does a description. That's one of our clips.
Okay.
So so that model is a little different than the DevOps. I know you guys using DevOps?
Yes.
Yeah. So but it creates error budgets. So what would have happened in that situation is the error budget would have been blown. Mm. But actually, I want to go one step further to the Netflix model, uh-huh. where they basically just encourage everyone to act like Loki. And just like, if you can break our stuff, break it.
Uh-huh.
Figuring that if our own guys can't break it, nobody can. Because it's just movies and who cares?
Right.
That's basically what the, you know.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's life support is on Netflix. So let's do this, guys.
Well, it depends what movies you're watching. I mean,
right, yeah. I mean, it depends. People may die over spoilers yet. I see it coming.
Yes.
It's going to be a series of serial killings called the spoiler murders. So we have a 1 month spoiler rule here. So okay. After that, you're on your own.
That's fair.
So that way we won't be the first targets, right?
Right.
You don't have to be faster than the bear, just faster than the slowest camper.
Yes, that's right. Very good.
We will not be victims of the spoiler murder. Mm. So it sounds almost like Azure is using the chaos model, the Netflix chaos model. Like, let's see if I can break it. I broke it. Yes.
I will say though, you know, props to them that we've been using Azure for, I'll say, you know, 3-4 years, whatever, and definitely the reliability and the usability has gone up. Now, of course, on my side of the fence, my part of the company, we're running Linux in Microsoft Azure, so already this is kind of a, you know, going against the grain, but it works.
Right. How are the tools in Linux? Are they good? You know, the local host tools?
We basically, you know, roll our own. We do our own thing. We kind of we're just in a hosting environment, and we run our VMs, and we don't use a lot of the Azure services because we've just sort of, you know, cobbled our own things together, Docker
right.
and Ansible, and just, you know.
That's good. It's more portable that way.
Exactly, right. That's why I worry a little bit about those who invest too much in, you know, the services technology, because mm-hmm. what if suddenly your CEO says, you know what, it's too expensive here. Let's shift to Amazon Web Services. Oh, well, we've just, you know, bet the farm on all of the services by, you know, that are given by Microsoft. So how do you do that?
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. So anyway, that's what we have there.
Right, hybrid. Right. Do you want to talk about your company at all, or are you
I'm happy to talk about my company. It's kind of interesting.
Totally seriously, because some people are under NDAs or not disclosures,
anything
or anything secret. Or
anything that I say is totally legal, so don't worry.
Okay.
Totally legal, yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So my company actually was founded in 2011, so we still consider ourselves a startup. We were formed from the Digital Health Group from Intel and mm-hmm. the similar Digital Health Group in General Electric. So they decided to take those two groups and form a company that would, you know, do technology for healthcare.
Okay.
And so in 2011,
Good, I didn't come out too hard on Intel.
Yeah. Yes, we want to be a little nicer to them. Yes. That's what we call them, our parents, you know, in our company.
Right.
So the company was headquartered outside of Sacramento in Roseville, California. We had offices in Oregon and offices in New York City. So so I ended up consulting for the company and ended up with a full-time job there. But this company does remote patient management, basically. So the bread and butter of the company are a couple of different products. The one that I tend to work on the most has been around for quite a long time, where seniors who are living in assisted living facilities, memory care, they want to go about their regular day and they don't want to have any intrusions of being monitored. So we just use motion sensors, and motion sensors placed around the room and in the facility, and we can see their pattern of living.
So it's creepy, but in a sneaky way.
Yes. We're not watching them, except we really are.
Do you think do you think they're typically aware of it, or is the goal to make it so they're not aware it's even there?
That's that they're not aware. They just, so if you watch a pattern, you know, Aunt Susie has been, you know, going to the bathroom reliably for 2 weeks twice a night, and now it's 5 times, 6 times. Well, now we know maybe she has a urinary tract infection. So
right. So
now it's time to have her caregiver, you know, talk to her some.
Wow,
better
is medicine. This like a replacement for nursing homes? Is that kind of
it's,
like?
No, but it's something that a home could use as a supplement to the.
Well, I mean, like,
care.
But think about it, right? So you're an adult child uh-huh. of, you know, of a senior parent.
Right.
You know, you're facing the decision, am I going to put my parent in a home?
Right.
And something like this technology means you might not have to.
Right.
You'd be able to just wire up their own residence
right.
with this stuff,
and
then a caregiver could be, you know, brought with, you know, like, not somebody who's at risk of sudden cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I mean, everyone
right.
is, but, right. you know.
That's yeah. right. Yes.
Especially in New York.
One bad stock deal away from a cardiac arrest.
Woohoo! Cardiac capital of the world. All right. So,
Yeah, so I mean, it is possible, and I know that our company had tried to market the product for home use as well, but it seemed to just settle better into the managed living, senior living space,
the
institutional space. So we have that, and the other side of the fence, newer,
lack of imagination, on the part of the possible customer. This is part of the problem. I mean, if people really understood what this meant, I mean, that awkward Thanksgiving dinner wouldn't have to be so awkward when everyone's like, "You put grandma in a home." I'd be like, "Well, I didn't know there was any alternative." If people were more technologically oriented, they would have taken this seriously as a home use product.
Right.
I'm actually pretty bummed out. So, what's the name of the company? So you do still sell home use kits, right?
Or actually, not right now. No, it's really just meant to.
They just couldn't pitch it.
Yeah, and the technology right now that we use.
Is there a possible retail path for this in the future? Or?
Well, the way the company is positioning it right now, they don't feel that this is business to business type stuff. They don't feel that this product. There are other products that are, but this product is going to really be used in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the other product that we have, so that product is called QuietCare. The product that is seeing a great expansion is called Health Harmony. And Health Harmony is very simple. You have a tablet. Right now it's an iOS tablet, but we're expanding to Android and Bluetooth devices. So so now you are in your home, and now the doctor can watch a video of you, interview you, can monitor your blood pressure, your step on a scale every day. So you have a health care program that you follow every day. We take your measurements remotely, and your nurses and your caregivers can look at the data and assess your health. So that's definitely a more of a home use.
Right. Yeah. So that's exciting, but honestly, the QuietCare to me. Maybe it's just my nerdiness is coming out, but I just think that's
also you probably
creepily intrusive, but also phenomenal.
Right.
I mean, if I was on the rope, all right, it's a joke, but it's not. Mm-hmm. Like my wife, once in a while, will come out when I'm working on a project in the garage or something, or working on a car, come out and say, "Hey, how you doing?" Make sure I'm not dead, or I don't have a car hasn't fallen on me and I'm pinned under it and can't get to my cell phone.
Yes,
because it's not that's one of my fears, and I'm older. I don't want my kids to have to face that decision.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, sorry. I know that's not what they do, but it's a shame that they bailed on it, and I hope that in the future they feel comfortable that it's a good cost model to go back to. I guess the real problem is if you're putting sensors all over your house, you got to maintain that.
Right.
You almost need an alarm system company kind of style service company to come in and deal with that in the house.
True. That actually is a large part of the problem. Again, the technology that we use now, the product is kind of sitting there. We haven't really had a lot of resources to develop it further and to use some of the newer technology. It runs on Zigbee, for example, and so right now it would be nice.
What's Zigbee?
Zigbee's a can't quote you the actual protocol. I know Steve can look it up, but
it's a protocol. Okay.
Yeah,
that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Zigbee.
Yeah. Z-Wave is a competing protocol for
Z-Wave. Okay.
Yeah. These are mesh networks. Devices can create their own.
Oh, very cool.
Networks.
So you guys are into network technology.
Yeah. It's really pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so the sensors all sort of find their friends and talk to each other and you have this. But yeah, there's some maintenance involved. So again, the technology that we use there, we had experimented with bringing it up into some more Internet of Things type of approach. But again, we needed to put our resources elsewhere. We are still a startup. We still have a small pool of developers to work on.
Right. Yeah. Well, so how's DevOps working for you guys? Is it like are you happy with it?
I saw the light about maybe 3 years or so ago. We had a gentleman come in, good friend of mine now, who joined the company, and he was an evangelist of DevOps and doing things smarter than the way that things had done before. So we, some of us at least, the group that I work with him, we took that on and we said, okay, let's start using some of these tools. Let's start doing continuous integration. Let's start doing Docker and Ansible and be right. He was more of a devs guy. I was more of an ops guy. We got along very well.
Right.
Yeah, Zigbee stuff.
Okay.
It's Z-I-G-B-E-E, correct?
That's right.
All right. So Zigbee is an IEEE 802.15.4 based specification for a suite of high-level communication protocols used to create personal area networks with small, low-power digital radios, such as for home automation, medical device data collection, and other low-powered, low-bandwidth needs. Designed for small-scale projects with the need for wireless connection, hence Zigbee is a low-power, low-data rate, and close proximity wireless ad hoc network.
So just a reference for the viewers and also for Steve, that IEEE thing that they mentioned in there, that's that thing that Arnie's part of.
Yeah.
Yeah, IEEE, right? So, yeah. Right. Probably not Steve, part of the viewers, but, you know, in case anyone doesn't caught up with that. And also, DevOps, in case you don't know. Well, I don't know. You want to give it a quick explanation?
You go ahead. You actually did some good talks on DevOps at Lilac, so you
okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, so I'm not prepared. I was actually dissecting it to try to figure out why it worked.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'm going to go there.
Okay.
But really simple, the idea of DevOps, SRE, and the Netflix model. Well, not the Netflix model, but SRE to less of a degree and more of a degree DevOps and Scrum are time management. And the idea is what you're doing is you're trying to categorize all of your projects and weigh them and order them. And that way, by keeping track of what, you might be like, oh, you know, big deal, it's an organizer.
Yeah.
But it's not just an organizer for one person, it's an organizer for a group of people using that computer interface to figure out how to prioritize their projects. Because the problem in the computer world is there's infinite possibilities with things that you can do. You can keep yourself busy doing something completely useless for years.
Yes, yes.
You know,
look at Wally in Dilbert. He's
right, right.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, and the thing is, it can all be approved, and also another one of the problems is that in a normal business scenario, and this is true in any business. So this stuff can be. This actually came from Japanese car manufacturing. I think. Is that right? I think it was from Japan. Scrum was from Japan originally. Yeah. And that's where the DevOps ideas came from,
right.
The Scrum ideas. Mm-hmm. And it was just a way to flag what states different things were in.
Mm.
Because otherwise it was too easy to get disorganized and people were just running around twiddling their thumbs between projects and it wasn't a fluid enough assembly line if the project is sufficiently complex.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it was a way to decomplexify projects. And one of the things that creates problems in complex projects is something called siloing.
Yes.
And that's where someone has a critical task. It's where almost like economy of scale gets turned on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And where someone becomes a specialist in something, but they have their own needs and their own processes that are out of sync with the processes of the rest of the organization.
Right.
And they can actually become a bottleneck and slow everything down.
Yep.
Maybe unwittingly. You know, it doesn't have to be about intent.
Right.
You know, it can, and that's a really important part of DevOps.
Although sometimes it is, right? Because
as we
yeah.
They deserve a fucking fuckers for that. Yeah. The union mentality, you know, not the good union mentality where we're going to get good benefits for us, the union mentality where I'm not going to do any work and you can't fire me.
Right, right.
Yeah, take my heels in.
That's right, and I'm going to only give you a little bit of information, but I'm going to still hold on. Yeah, so the silos, right, which of course then the silos are a big problem, and anybody who's worked in business and has to communicate information back and forth knows, you know, silos are the worst because, you know, you need some information. It needs to be shared, you know, not
right.
Hidden. So
was that a reasonably good explanation?
Yeah, I think so, and I think...
Is there something in your workflow that I didn't mention?
You mentioned Scrum, and I think that's a key part of it for us. You know, the you know, getting away from the waterfall model of
right, right. There's two competing design methodologies: the Scrum way to do DevOps, and there's also waterfall.
Waterfall, yeah, right. You're iterating much quicker. You're seeing incremental changes happen faster rather than having these massive projects with 8 month release cycles and things like that.
Right, right.
You know, and again, I think the communication between the development side of the house and the operations side of the house, where everybody tries to understand each other and work together better, that...
You know, I wonder if this is something that I haven't talked to any guests about, but, you know, so feel free if this is too out there. But, like, I wonder if you have to go to a DevOps model first before you can look at an SRE kind of model. Like, at least you have to examine it and give it a real think through, even if you don't adopt it. You know, to get into the mindset where you can start doing error budgets and organizing people.
That's a conceptual leap, right?
It seems like it's too far out there to like go from just a ticketing system where everything's a problem, right? And it's flat. Right. That's the problem with a ticketing system. You experience them all the time, even if you don't realize it.
Yeah.
You know, if you have an order number with a company, that's a ticket, essentially.
Absolutely.
And it's a flat system, and everybody's order is equal. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, within a company, if you're trying to get to C, you got to get A and B done, and if B is siloing, you're never going to get to C. And if they're all flat, it doesn't reflect the importance of B being timely. You know,
right.
It needs to be some kind of time component to how, you know, time and volume component to each task that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not enough. It's not enough. An early lesson that you learn in computer science is, if you shove more than one data type into a field, you're going to get garbage out.
Yes.
You have to break them down into tinier and tinier. Every time you can break down into another field, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that new data may have some value to making things more efficient.
Right.
In programming and in human organization.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
Yeah. So.
But anyway, I DevOps, I only know it from the one company where I'm at. You know, I don't have experience doing this philosophy at other companies, so it's always hard to say, well, you know, what way is better, but...
this is the way!
That's right. This is all I know.
This is the only way!
Right.
Yeah, we know how that goes. I think that you're going to have to adopt it to different... Because also different companies have different priorities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why some have the waterfall model, which is more of a fire-ready aim.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are kind of... It makes sense that you guys are more of a scrum model, which tends to be more of a... more of a down-to-earth kind of like, okay, we can't fail, you know, like ready, aim, fire.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, even if it's a highly redundant mesh network and there's some expectation of failure, you know, things are going to be critical at some point.
Right.
There's going to be a critical level of failure where it's like, oh, this is not okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but you know, again, it works well for us, and you know, we are a small company, so we really need to make sure that the communication channels are good. Anybody's got a block going on, that a silo or some problem like that, we got to let each other know about it. And we're also remote. I work, you know, remotely from Long Island. We've got other people, engineers and salespeople, and everybody working from different points around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're centered in California. We're actually now in Folsom, just down the road from Intel. We moved. Half of the company, maybe a little bit more, sits in an office, and the rest of us are remote. So our communication skills have to be good.
Right.
And we use Slack. Slack is good.
Really? Tell me about Slack.
Yeah, Slack is a really awesome messaging app. I believe my friend who sort of introduced DevOps to us was the one who also brought Slack into the company. And it's very rich because you can set up your own channel. So you basically have a Slack account. I believe there's a free model. There's a you know, a not very expensive model. Depends on how much history of your chats that you want to keep and have access to. But anyway, so you can set up your users, set up different channels of communication. And the other thing you can do is you can set up your applications. For myself, monitoring applications that can talk to Slack. So I'm at my MacBook and I'm running Slack. I've got Slack open all day. So
the idea is you're not just getting bugged by your coworkers, you can run your messages in or out of automation.
Yes.
So you can script, like if there's some event, like a network event or a data storage event or something, or someone's an attack,
right.
It can turn into a message and it can interrupt everyone who's just kind of goofing off and going, hey, yeah, what are we going to do
next?
Hey,
I can share YouTube videos on Slack. Oh, but wait a minute.
Check out this picture of a kitten and then the bot comes in and goes, wait, guys, something important is happening.
Wait, the data center's on fire. All right. Just put the fire out, but we got to watch this video.
We have to watch less kitten videos so the data center stops burning.
Yes, yes. So that's why Slack, you've got multimedia.
Right.
You can do a lot of stuff. You can create private channels or channels that anyone in your organization, your group, whatever, can use. So I think it's great.
I found a really good alternative that I've been using to Slack called Discord. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Matt.
Heard about it.
Discord is like a Slack for people who play games, and it's completely free of charge. Like every feature of it is completely free.
That's cool.
However, it lets you also do video chats in it as well.
Ah.
So you do video and voice chats, and then then the servers that you make, you can have like infinite chat rooms and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you can organize everyone, give everyone special roles. So if you have like a project, because I've done this before, where you're delegating a client, you give a client a special role so they can only access certain channels.
Right. Nice. But there's a, so
I guess these are both closed source protocols and companies, right? Because I know there's a lot of open source people using Slack.
Yeah.
There's a lot of open source features.
Mm. It has an open API, I'm sure.
It does.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, it'd just be interesting to see if, well, you know what, I guess in a way it is, the barrier to entry to writing a new one seems like it would be plausible for a well-funded startup. So I guess they have to behave. As long as that's true.
Right.
You know, and because it's usually used within a company, Discord, on the other hand, actually, maybe not, because, of course, the social network isn't a coherent group of people. There isn't a boss to say, you're going to switch or you're fired.
Yeah.
So they might end up being more like a Twitter or a Facebook, where they have more control and can extract more money, so to speak.
No, it's pretty different on Discord. Discord, the API is on C#. So if you know C#, you could program what's called bots, and then bots do all that in automation for you.
Right.
If you want a bot delegated, where if you just say, play the song, it plays the song for you. If you want a bot to do like this or that or whatever, it does it for you. Then you can set other automation beyond that. So you can, so like if you set up for a business, you can get it to run like you would for Slack for a business.
So far, but there's always the risk of a future banhammer. You know what I mean?
Yes. On Discord, no. Discord's not like that. There's no like administration. If you say like the wrong words or whatever, you get banned. It's entirely at like if you get
so
banned,
far is what I'm
no,
saying.
No, but no,
Twitter used to be like that too. It's completely
open.
You can
do
whatever you want.
The way Discord is that like if you say something that the server host doesn't like, then they ban you from the server.
Right.
That's it. It's not like Discord administration gets involved with
that. Oh, I see. So so it's really the Discord is just a protocol with a central metadata server, but the actual administrators of the Discord servers are the ones calling the shots on what can happen on the
server. So you're in different spots. Think about it like Facebook groups, you know? Mm-hmm. Like I have different Facebook groups, but
Mumble also has something like this too, which is like kind of has Skype features in it as well. So there was there's one that was like I forgot the name of it. Anyway, there's an open source one that's basically descended into chaos because people took over servers and made it highly political. And it was there was a lot of buzz about it. I remember in our user group, and it just kind of faded off, and everyone went, whatever, you know.
Right.
And they switched over to Slack. but that's good to hear. Thanks for the info about Discord. I hadn't really played with it, so that's good. That's good info. So, and I'm glad to hear there's a C#, and of course C# is available on Linux now too, so it's not like an Apple, so it's not like you're trapped in one platform.
Right.
Microsoft's really done a great job of getting away from that. I hate to sound like a fanboy.
Yeah.
They're making it hard to not be positive about them lately.
It's funny, right? I wasn't sure we'd ever get to this day, but then again, I wasn't sure we'd ever get to the day where Linux was so, you know.
Remember like 10 years ago, I'm like, Linux has won!
Yes, right.
I'm not so sure anymore, but yeah. Not against Microsoft. I think Microsoft is not the problem anymore. I think, if anything, it seems like more people have been pitching for these mega tech corps, you know. And it's not all bad.
Right.
And I got into a discussion with, who was it? One of the guests. And we were talking about how, you know, they really do a lot of good in open source, and they contribute a lot of code.
Mm.
But the problem is they contribute the code in a very narrow band, right? So, like, if all open source is this, the big tech companies are heavily contributing in this little strip.
Yeah,
and not in this, not in the periphery. And sometimes it's about solving weird problems. So,
right.
I hope that that's unfair, and I invite people to tell me why that's unfair. So, you know, and anyway, so I'm kind of getting off of the topic. I wanted to talk to you about how you got into computers.
Ah, the long and winding road.
Yes,
you have about 18 hours. It's very interesting. I think about this often. I think about my background and where I come from, right? So for your viewers who are either good at trivia or who are good at Google, I was actually born right at the very end of the baby boomer era. So the year I was born was the year that the Mets started playing in the in the National League. And I actually have the reproduction of the front page of the New York Times.
Well, you look good.
Well, thank you. the front cover of the New York Times.
I think I'm more gray than you are, so.
And gee, we have the same number of children, I think. How did that happen?
Yeah. Same name, same number of children.
Yeah, this is interesting. but anyway, so Marilyn Monroe died the day before I was born. So that's how far back I go.
Wow.
So, and at the time, my parents are both blue-collar people. My father was first generation. His parents came over from Italy. Yes, really did come over on a boat. my mom's grandparents came over from, I believe, Sweden. So, and both of my parents and their families worked blue-collar jobs. You know, very interesting. So my father's family my grandfather was a tailor, my grandmother was a seamstress, and my mother's side of the family, they all worked for the New York City Transit. So here I am, born in Brooklyn.
Which, by the way, the technicals of the New York City Transit system haven't really changed since then.
You're right. And actually, yes,
apparently that's not a good thing, according to the mayor and the governor and everyone.
A very good point. Yes. Yeah. Some things don't quite change.
That's what happens when you don't shut stuff off ever. Right. You can't upgrade it.
That's right. So I was born in an era. Well, first of all, my background is of my parents, who are of this, their background, blue collar, right? So we moved from Brooklyn to Long Island. We actually moved on the day that Kennedy was assassinated. So again, trivia buffs, you can figure that date out.
Astrologists everywhere are frantically shuffling paper.
Right. So
he's the one.
That's right. But Long Island in the mid to early 60s started booming, right? But we had suburbs were exploding, and something else was happening. We were having the growth of a lot of schools, education, but the Cold War was still going on, right? And so, Kennedy was assassinated, the Vietnam War was starting to escalate, and so in the midst of all this are a whole bunch of, thousands and thousands of kids growing up on Long Island who were being, taught somehow, some way. So, I know, you probably didn't experience this because I know you're a little bit younger than I am, but we were taught the new math in the end of the 60s and the early 70s.
Yes. Did you see Isaac's talk?
I didn't get to see that part of his talk.
Okay, so there's a link in Isaac's talk to new math, routine.
So there you go.
Yeah, he talked about it too. Yeah.
And actually, we thought, our teachers in the early 70s, that we were going to go metric in this country, right? So we actually learned, we pushed aside the whole imperial system and we learned everything metric. So I'm very familiar with with meters and cubic centimeters. I really,
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned before that you were mechanical.
Yes.
And I asked you about it, and you said you do some carpentry.
Yes, I do.
Right.
Right.
Do you do when you're doing carpentry, do you have to sit down and do the math when you're figuring out an angle or a distance or something like that, or can you do the fractions in your head?
Now, interesting, that I can, right? Because I learned carpentry from my dad, and of course, metric system to him, what is this? So I learned how to use that, right? The imperial.
So you learn how to
reading eighths and sixteenths
just have a gigantic table in your head where you memorize it all.
That's right. But where it comes into a problem is cooking, because cups and gallons, I'm really bad with that stuff. Quarts, I mean, give me a liter, give me a,
glug, 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 three glugs.
Yes, three glugs. Right. So, unfortunately, the metric system was supposed to take off in this country. It really didn't, and all of us are in this wake of.
So I can actually give you a contrast to this. Mm. So I built some stuff for my van. I'm not like a heavy woodworker, but I've built some pretty complex stuff with a lot of angles. Mm-hmm. And you got to do some math. It really comes in handy having the imperial system, because you do everything in fractions.
Yes.
The fractions naturally lend themselves to the math that you're typically doing you're building small scale in inches and feet kind of woodworking.
Right. As much as we like to move decimal points.
Okay, I know how long this has to be.
It does work out.
Yeah. So, I saw this on a carpentry channel, actually, mm-hmm. and they were explaining that was why they did it.
Right.
And it's become like this very old kind of of, you know, tradition that was passed on from, because our brains just kind of happen to flow that way a little bit better than when you're doing things in decimals and you have to sit down and do the math on a sheet of paper, which, of course, you typically don't have a sheet of paper, so then you're writing on the wood with the pencil, and then you're erasing the pencil before you stain the thing or got under the wood glue and you can't get the, you can't get the numbers off.
And you've got a mess when you could have just
made it
simple.
So there's a bunch of 70s vintage furniture, and the way to tell if they're authentic is there's a lot of decimal math written in pencil under the stain.
Awesome. That's awesome, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, no, that could be true.
It could be true.
And now we're the Antiques Roadshow. Anyway, so keep going. But how was that for a segue?
Not bad.
Yes.
Not bad.
Segue.
Right? Now, I had a lot of friends whose parents, fathers mostly, of course, you know, worked for Grumman and Sperry, you know, whatever. So we had a lot of engineers on Long Island because we were racing to get to the moon. And I think for me, the fact that to actually watch broadcast of you know, the moon landings going on, and I remember this, watching it in school, watching it at home, was definitely, you know, got me jazzed on science. And
right.
Yeah.
So did you do any home brewed science based on what you were seeing, or?
I think not. I don't think so. I mean, it's very possible. I just don't remember that as being.
Just a quick thing. You know, I know we have some very skeptical, conspiracy theory minded people in the audience. Mm-hmm. So I assume you really think we went to the moon.
Well, I actually saw a cartoon about this the other day, and it, basically the premise was that in order to make this be so realistic that NASA was faking this, that they had to do it on the moon in order to make it look really fake. So maybe that's what happened.
So actually, I had a great conversation with one of our user group people in our user group, and he's like, "It's so obvious. They actually that this was happening. This kind of skepticism was even stronger in some circles at the time.
Uh-huh.
Some people were like, 'Oh, this is BS. It's just movie magic.' And one of the reasons was Kubrick. So Stanley Kubrick had written 2001, and before we were even in space and could see the planet from space."
Right.
He was already coming up with accurate representations of what it looked like.
Right.
So on the one hand, it was like, wow, great movie. You know, that's the easy.
1968 was that movie, right?
That was like the easy solution to like to say, oh, great movie.
Yeah.
But there also, as a skeptical point of view, is like, well, if he could figure it out and fake it, who knows it's real at all?
Right.
Right. Okay. You know. So and then the easy answer is, well, so apparently there was a reaction to that skepticism either from other people in our country or around the world. They put mirrors on the moon.
Huh.
If you time it right, you could shine a light at the mirrors on the moon and they'll shine back.
Mm-hmm.
So no idea about the math about that, though. So. But yes, it is verifiable that we've been, that a human being with a mirror has been on the moon and left it there.
Good, right. So. Plus there are still a bunch of golf balls up there, so you know, it's...
I don't know. Is there a telescope powerful enough to see the golf balls yet that you can
be.
Have
there's
at home?
There's got to be, right?
Well, you know, that's a, you know, of course, you have secret lenses or secret computer programs or you're editing it or, you know, I went into a rant the other on one of the other shows about how you could easily send. You know, I like it when people do homebrewed science. It's awesome because worst case scenario, they're just going to be just as skeptical as they were before. But best case scenario, you have a new scientist.
Right.
You have somebody who figured out how to shine the laser of the moon, how to shine back, and they're just like, you know, they just have their moment of zen, and they realize, I know what I'm supposed to do with my life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in making more scientists, and there's plenty of home. And another one was the Lyluggers did a Mylar balloon and set it up into space, and you could see we had a space trip in our user group. So you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, it's very possible. My friends and I just don't remember very well. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But
I don't remember a lot of that back then.
Yeah.
You know, people you believe it or you didn't. You didn't fight.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't fight the current.
Yeah, yeah. We were too young to be skeptical, but I think we also just fell right into it, and we did. We enjoyed it. So, I guess if you fast forward to the late 70s now, I'm in high school, and computers are starting to come into schools. I was a geek, but. The guys who were using computers in the late 70s and 90s, those were the real geeks. I didn't want to say that. I was one of those geeks. I'm just an average run-of-the-mill geek.
Right,
So I never associated myself with computers, and I don't know what they were, but they didn't even have...
We're all geeks. It's just the time.
That's
you know.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
No video terminals. Right? These are the teletype, you know, paper, tractor-fed paper where was your output.
Right.
Right. So that was my view of computers and technology. Well, I loved science, and I knew I went to college to study science. And so, having all of this background in the moon landings and just loving science and math, and we come to and wanting to stay away from computers, we come to 1983, the summer of 1983, and there was this great movie that came out with Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy and
Inspector Gadget, right?
Oh, well, no. That was a good one too.
Decade and a half later.
Right.
Yeah,
right. But I mean, War Games to me was just phenomenal. And so I saw this movie and I said, you know, this computers are cool. and I signed myself up for a computer science course that fall, starting my senior year in college. And I took the only organized course in computers that I ever took. I never studied computer science in college, mm-hmm. Never studied programming formally except for that one class. Learned to program in Fortran 77. Oh, yes, it was a joy.
Wow.
yes, it's pretty fun.
Did you have a version at home, or was it just your...
No, because I was away at school, so I did it in school and
wow.
learned and did
How
the
much
class.
Did it cost?
I'm not really sure. I mean, it was all part of the course.
Oh, it was part of the course.
Of my
it was
degree.
Included with the course.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I remember I was bugging my mom to get me... It was like... Time machine moment. If I could do one thing to go back in time and fix my own past, I would get just bug her a little harder. I was bugging my mom for a copy of C to run a window under run on a DOS.
Right.
And it
right.
was $300, and she's like, "I'm not doing that."
That's
It was a substantial amount of money back then.
Right.
But like now, oh my God, you have to do this, lady.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a lot of computer stuff in my life, so it wasn't like I didn't have any exposure, but that would have been great.
Yeah.
I would have had a huge leg up then.
For sure.
Yeah, so, you know, you have it now, you have it for free, right? So all the, we were talking about all these barriers to entry. I hope you don't mind if I segue a little bit.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
So
you're right.
You're kind of joking about how these, you know, those geeks were the real geeks, you know, but in a way, not really. They were kind of the technocrats, in a way.
Yes.
You know, and the reason I say that is because, you know, barriers to entry don't make you a geek. And this is something that we have something new in Linux that's happened now, particularly with Raspberry Pis, just because they're so cheap.
Yep.
And they can do 80% of what you can do on any desktop, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe the high-end stuff like, you know, the editing and streaming software we use for this program you know, like, you know, kind of 3D modeling, that kind of stuff, maybe not. Or, you know, playing the latest games, but they're really capable.
But you run your entire house, your home assistant on a Raspberry Pi.
You can run it on 5 volts on a battery you can carry in your pocket.
Yep.
I mean, it really is so cheap to just run a computer. Now, there are no barriers to entry. So, in a way, open source is the perfect meritocracy. So, I don't know. I'd like to come back to that later. It's going to be too much of a damper on your story, but let's come back to meritocracy when you're done.
Yeah, that's a good topic, too. So, I guess, you know, we're a product of our environment, for sure, and things that influence us, and we're never quite sure the path that we're taking. And so by the time I finished with college, I thought I was going into medicine, but I didn't get into medical school. So I ended up...
You wanted to be a doctor?
I wanted to be a doctor, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And
why didn't you get into medical school? Grades weren't good enough?
Just not good enough. I mean, because you had to have straight A's. I didn't have straight A's. So, you know, it's... And even then, very, very competitive, you know, and say what you will about...
seems like most doctors that actually became... most of the people I've talked to actually became doctors. They had to try several times.
Yes, right.
And you have to be. Yes. You can't get discouraged. So
I did try a second
if your kid,
time.
If you you want to become a doctor, or your kid wants to become a doctor, keep encouraging them if that's what they want to do.
Oh, sure.
Because you can't just give up. You know, nobody gets like it's not too common that people get everything just smooth sailing the first shot.
Right. But you know, my science background and my love for not only biology but chemistry came into play because I wasn't going to go into medical school, but I found the field of analytical chemistry to be very interesting. So I started working for companies and doing chemistry work. That's actually how I got to Brookhaven Lab as an analytical chemist.
It's funny what you were saying about the gallons and ounces and stuff. And you're working on chemistry degree.
But thankfully, everything's in the metric system.
Of course, that was...
So, good thing, right?
You know, all those people with the cooking at home are crazy, man. You guys know what's going on.
That's right.
Base 10, baby.
That's right. That's right. You know, our volumetric flasks and everything are beautiful. You don't have that in your kitchen. Come on. That put me in a position to start to be exposed to computers because A, I was at Brookhaven Lab, and B, I was in a field where computers were really starting to take off, and all of our equipment that we were starting to use in a laboratory.
Holy
work.
How did I not know all this stuff about you? This is great.
Well, we haven't known each other that long, so, you know.
Yeah, I know, right?
No, only a few 20, decades. Only 20 years, right.
It's like 2.5 decades, right?
So, almost by accident, here I found myself immersed in computer stuff, and I realized think or swim, you really got to learn computers. Just like, you know, our folks today who have to figure out how to use their, maybe our parents, the VCR, you know, or your cell phone or whatever.
Or even spreadsheets. I think spreadsheets have been dominating since like early 90s.
Yeah,
so I think at this point, it's a must.
Right. That you need to
no matter what your role is.
And word processors too. And use a word processor the right way, you know, if you're going to use one at all and not use Lix. But anyway, that's beside the point. And LaTeX, LaTeX. I looked at all this computer stuff and said, you know, I really would like to be able to, I wish I could program more than just Fortran 77 and really do stuff. And a friend of mine came along, because you know him too, Tim Saylor, right? And Tim said, you know, you should really try Linux. And I said,
Tim was your Linux guru?
What is Linux, right? So this is...
Yeah, everyone started learning Linux back in those days had a Linux guru.
Yeah.
Someone who went, hey, look at this, you got to see this,
right,
this is good.
Right, and this was like 1993, and the Linux kernel had only been out about a year or so or whatever, right?
Oh,
a year or two.
Interesting.
So, and one thing led to another, and we formed a user group at Brookhaven Lab, and we met actually every Tuesday, but we met once a week in our user group, and it was like, for me, learning a foreign language, because I had, you know, one meeting, people started talking about compiling their kernel. And I'm like, what is this guy talking about? Well, I better try to figure this out, because I was never exposed to that sort of stuff in a formal, you know, way of being educated.
So, right, right.
Yeah. So our user group was pretty cool, and we learned a lot of stuff, and we met every week, and then some of us left the lab, but that's where Farmingdale came in, right? And the Farmingdale, the flat group.
Right.
I sent
an email over to Tim said, hey, you know, you guys want to come meet over here? We're trying to make a user group. And they're like, we can't get people in the door.
Right. Yeah, you can't come on lab property, right?
Right. BNL is a Department of Energy property.
Yes.
And, I mean, like, they had armed guards. Mm-hmm. There was a reactor on site. You know,
right.
It was
that was
pain.
Even before 9/11, before security was really big. You still couldn't get in.
It was a really bad place to host a user group.
Right.
So you guys couldn't easily have people from the outside. You did have some people from the outside, though.
We did. We did have some people come in and all, but the great stroke of genius was to bring together a group of young college whippersnappers and a bunch of starting to become old fogies from Brookhaven Lab and fuse this together into a user group. And as they say, the rest is history. But we've had
a 20 plus year run.
Yeah,
and you were a secretary for up until a couple of years ago.
Right.
Yeah. And you got really busy.
Yeah.
And you just were like, I can't do this anymore. I'm just too busy. And I get it. I mean, there's been times that I wanted to pull, you know, just pull out. And at some point, I probably will, because...
You just said that 10 years ago. He's been president for the entire run.
You know, I've take my job, please. Somebody come run against me. I'm not even kidding. You know, I mean, really, it's fine. I mean, you know, so there's advantages to being old and cynical. You know, there's advantages when it comes to, like, you know, how do people really work? What will get people to a meeting? How do we get people to keep coming to a meeting?
Yeah.
And there's also disadvantages. You know, I'm not in a college. Mm-hmm. And, of course, who are all the new faces coming into the Linux world? You know, people who are in colleges, so I don't get to, you know, interact with them. Mm-hmm. We used to meet at a college, but after 9/11, it really got a lot more restricted.
Right.
Which hurt membership. We still have plenty of members.
Right.
But it's we don't get as many new people, new faces in and out as we used to.
Right. We also were very fortunate, not very far from here. We met at the Woodbury Extension for Cold Spring Harbor Lab for a few years too.
Right.
Yeah, and then thankfully.
So Matt is definitely one of the co-founders of Lilug. So thanks so much for all your effort there and you know diving headfirst into this weird Linux thing.
Yeah, well,
before it was cool.
And how important user groups
or even considered serious. You know, it was just considered hobbyist junk back then.
That's right. There were a lot of hobby groups. There were the photography groups and the Mac users group, and then there were these Linux crazies that would get together once a month and have this particular meeting, but we had some pretty good speakers. I think the pinnacle speaker, I actually looked this up before I came here today. Can you believe it was just about 10 years ago that Eric Raymond came to
10 years ago already?
2009.
I've had my Marauder that long. I drove him home in my Marauder that day.
Oh yeah. I mean, and to have a guy like that come out to Long Island and to answer questions.
I'm hoping to have him on the show.
Oh, well, that would be great.
Yeah. So the thing is, I want to give everybody, you know, everybody's always in such a rush in our business and in our field.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want to, I'm taking it slow with the show. There are so many interesting people in my life, and I want to give everybody who's interested in coming on the show, some people have already declined, and that's fine, but, like, you know, everybody at least a shot to, like, come out and say, hey, you know, this is me, this is what I'm doing, because there's so many interesting stories, and there's so much good crossover, and then to expand out from there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of the idea for the show is inspired by Lilug's parking lot conversations, right? So, you know, we'd have a meeting, we'd talk, like, serious tech, someone would come up with slides, and they did lots of research, and maybe they have a demo, and then we go out afterwards, we talk, what does this mean? What does this mean for humanity? What does this mean for the United States? What does this mean for the tech industry? And it would just go into these wild places, like over the rainbow, and I'm just like, I could package this and sell it. And here we are. And more recently I've been, open source is not just about Linux anymore.
Right.
It's breaking into all these other fields. And honestly, the only fields that are really doing well are the ones that have at least some kind of open source model competing. You know, the art field, the copyrighted artistic kind of fields, like music and movies and things like that are suffering because they don't have that.
Right.
You know, they don't have an open source-ish kind of model. I don't think it would be open,
right?
Because, I mean, I've done that, and it was not that great.
Right.
And this, you know, about my book, and I didn't make a cent on it.
Excellent
lots
book,
of people,
by the way. Yes.
Lots of people read it, but, you know, it didn't make a cent because I'm open source. I'm fine with that. Yeah. It was an experiment. I knew there was a risk. But, like, you know, there's got to be something between million-dollar contracts and, you know, completely free, and anybody can, you know, you just count on people's good faith to pay you.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm gonna get more into that. I have some ideas, but I wanted to, you know, this is your show, so I want you to when we're tough on you on a panel, when I pull you into a panel and they ask you the tough questions.
That's right.
You know, I want you to feel like you had your shot. So that's a great story. You know, you really have, like, give me hope for science as a meritocracy, hearing this story, you know, seeing you as a chemist, you know, switching over into Linux, and there really were, and your family didn't have the education that a lot of our other guests have had.
Right. I mean, no one really went to college in
A lot of our guests, their parents were techies of some description. And for has someone as smart as you be here. I mean, you know, like, you haven't even talked about this, but, I mean, you've been a DBA, a crack DBA, like the best in your field. Don't listen to him. And you've also been an administrator, you've been an engineer, you've been a programmer. So you've done a lot of different, so you didn't just learn, you know, one trick, you know, learn Linux and then you were done. I mean, you just keep learning and evolving and turning yourself, reinventing yourself into a tech.
Right.
And so that's a really good sign for this stuff that we were talking about with STEM and kids, you know, not, you know, that it isn't just a guild.
Right.
You know, that it isn't just a technocracy, that there really is some merit in our field.
And it's
sorry to make you the golden child, you know.
Well, it is kind of funny, and I've thought about this about my life as well, where, you know, if you ask my mother or father, would I be where I am today doing these kinds of things? We all say this, but the job that I have now and the jobs that I've had didn't exist when I was in high school. So I had no idea that I was going to do these things, because they just...
The whole tech field's like, all of IT's like that.
Of course, it's like, right, and that's going to be the same way for, say, my grandchildren. Their jobs that they have are not going to...
Yeah, you tell someone in 1992 that they would be managing 10,000 servers at the same time,
right,
and their head would explode. They'd be like,
there's not enough coffee.
Am I a robot?
Yes.
Am I an energy field reaching out to the phone line, like a la Lawnmower Man or something? You know?
Yeah, right.
It doesn't even make sense.
Virtual computing, people have that. No, cool.
Right. And of course, now in hindsight, that all looks very silly, and it's obvious how you do it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But that, well, my, obvious to us. Laugh at me.
Those in the know.
Those in the know. Yes.
It's funny too, because we laugh. My mom, my dad passed away. My mom's still alive, and only recently has she embraced the microwave and the she had a rotary phone up till only a few years ago, and so she's definitely the we talk about the dinosaur, right? She's she could be, but wonderful mom. But
there's some great videos out there of kids trying to figure out how to use rotary phones.
Oh, great!
It's awesome. Like they're pushing in the holes and stuff. What do I do with this thing?
I think I missed that.
I don't know. Sometimes I think there's staged. I'm like, this can't be real.
Yeah.
But maybe not. Maybe.
Who knows? That's their experience. They just don't have that, and we do. So anyway, so it's funny. Yeah. So no matter where you come
not
from.
Not having friends with zeros in their phone numbers.
Yeah. Yes.
I gave it away now.
Right. But really, no matter where you come from, no matter what your economic background is, if you have the desire and you're exposed, and this is the important thing about education too, if you're exposed to these things, then you're able to to take off, because we are a combination of our genetics, but also a combination of our environment too. So
and your Matt Sirico's proof. No, it's really good, because it was so that gives me, because there's been a lot of energy going into STEM, mm-hmm. and this idea that you want to get more people into computer science, and then of course there's this concept floating around about Scott Adams kind of coined it, about the knack. You have the knack. There's a predisposition to understand technical, technical terminology, technical processes, right. Be able to quickly learn. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of this argument going on that between just raw intelligence and some kind of knack mm-hmm. that only some people have.
Right. Well, I mean, we see this in music, right? Now, we both dabble in music, right? What's interesting about it is that I could never really be a professional musician, because my music skills take me to a point, but I don't feel that that they're good enough for me to be able to write hit songs or to play in a symphony orchestra or whatever. So mm-hmm. those who have that knack, that special skill, are going to be the ones who are going to excel. But that doesn't mean that I can't enjoy music and be a musician and do the music that I've done.
Well, maybe you would have if the timing had been different.
Right. So
for sure, mm-hmm. for sure, and I'll defend you a little bit. Mm-hmm. Some of it is the timing. People are just as much heroes as victims of the time mm-hmm. they live in.
True.
If you take Elvis and you put him now, he might fail.
Right.
Or he might only be like a niche.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So, whereas at the time he was perfect.
That was just the right place.
It was just the right amount of this and that.
Yeah.
Of course, if you look at someone like my favorite is Bowie, because someone described him to me perfectly, which is that he, instead of writing songs or even albums, he wrote genres.
He wrote genres.
If you're a musician that's at the level that you can write a genre, I mean even once, mm-hmm. then theoretically you should succeed at any time.
Mm, right.
Or even Mr. Bungle.
Right. So, I'm Twisted Sister, actually, I think they wrote that genre. Mm. You could look at there are other people who were imitating them. There was a series of imitators.
Sure.
Best example of a series of imitators, grunge. There were two or three bands that led the charge.
Right.
And I'm not saying those other bands weren't good,
right.
but really it was just, it's pretty obvious who those two or three bands were. Mm-hmm. There was a scene, mm-hmm. but the leaders were also the leaders in the scene
right.
before they made it.
Sure.
Before they became really well known.
Right.
So they wrote genres. Mm. They wrote a genre at least.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So so the question is, how does that tie into the knack?
Yeah. I think you're going to always have those who excel and who are meant to be, but I think it shouldn't be exclusionary, right? So
right.
I you mentioned STEM in education. I think it's really important for our young folks to be good at science and technology and engineering and math, right? To have some knowledge, because one of the worst things that happens is on the internet you read, product X is bad for you or good for you, and now suddenly everybody takes, wait a minute, product X was good last month and now it's bad, and people don't really understand how to gauge risk or to read science and get to the bottom of and investigate why a claim is proper or not and all that, right? So everybody should have that kind of knowledge. But the problem I think that's happening in education right now is we're so focused on STEM that we're starting to forget about the fine arts, for example, right?
Right.
Because everybody's got to be STEM. And I think that's where the knack comes in. You're going to have your stellar STEM people, but you got to expose children to STEM and to
It's so dumb and so obvious that this is happening. It makes me, the conspiracy theory corner of my brain lights up and goes, can they really be this dumb? They don't see how this is a problem, right? I mean, because, you know, language forms thinking, right? And, you know, like having an alpha reading left to right, right, or reading right to left affects the way you think. You know, people who have alphanumeric, like ABC, right? You know, or Chinese characters. I'm just going to make something up. I don't know what this says.
This is not real Chinese. It's
probably dirty, but, you know, you have strokes and dots, you know.
Right.
And like that, God, who knows what that is, but...
That's a bad word for
it. I'm sorry if that says something offensive. But this, to when I see that, it's so... And this is not my idea. This is Neil Stephenson's idea, you know, or maybe even before him there was someone. But, you know, it's so obviously a circuit board, you know.
Yeah.
It affects the way you think about, you know, and as opposed to... where these linear strings of alphanumeric characters are so obviously a program. So, you know, like how the framework, and of course, how does this relate to music? Well, in music, you know, you have this idea where you have you have multiple, if you think about it in terms of sheet music, you have multiple pieces to any particular score going at the same time, converging at various points, and then separating it and doing different things.
Yes.
You know, you have harmonies, but you also have kind of some level of discord.
Sometimes, yes.
And what does that remind you of? Of course, it reminds you of hyper-threading, where things are spinning off in the background, and, you know, and loops, where things are spinning off, and there's a lot of loops in music, too.
Yes.
So these are concepts that you learn from an early age by taking a music class in third grade or something, and it forms that archetype in your brain, and you're better at it.
Right.
But if all you're doing is just crunching numbers and answering, you know, science word problems,
Or even worse, doing Common Core problems, we won't go into that.
Right?
You're really twisting your brain.
The answer to STEM was what we were doing all along, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, so and if you're just looking for people who can just, you know, repeat the same problems, the same answers to the same problems over and over and over again, they're not really doing anything. What are they really doing?
Right.
You know. Yeah. You know, and of course, the worst part about all this is that's a very industrial approach to education. And, you know, this kind of assembly line mentality, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into this too much because we've gone over this quite a bit in the show, but that assembly line mentality is just useless in a highly automated artificial intelligence, machine learning. You know, we're not at artificial intelligence yet, but machine learning is going to lead there eventually.
Right,
it might be sooner, maybe later, but we're headed there.
Yeah.
And in an AI, you know, in a rapid machine learning world or an AI world, creativity is the only thing that matters.
Yes.
Because the computer is going to be better at you than everything else.
Right. And
you know,
creativity is so important to express. I mean, you've written a book. You know, you do cartooning, right? You know, and yet you're also a, you know, you're a.
I'm awful, but yes, I do cartooning.
Yeah, he does.
Because I just have to get it right once. That's it. I can just get it wrong over and over. No. Passable.
Undo.
Control Z. Just
yes,
lean on
right.
it.
Control Z is your friend.
All right, let's start over.
I've got a macro set up, so just keep pressing it.
My hard drive is a wasteland of dead ideas. Yeah.
But I mean, humans are meant to be creative. Everybody's got some kind of creative spark in something or other, and I think we have to force to that more, you know, in spite of the
pressure to do otherwise.
I wish
we could alleviate the pressure. I really do, because like, you know, here's something kind of controversial. I mean, and it sounds like it's true for you too. The biggest things I've accomplished in my life were things that no one told me to do. People may have even told me not to do, or not any kind of officially blessed activity. I've succeeded because I rebel and I'm stepping away from whatever the norm is.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Linux is very much like that. And I think one of the reasons Linux was just screaming in the early days of Linux is because all these people are like, finally, I have someplace to express myself.
Yes. Yeah. You know? And also if you like the underdog, again, being a Mets fan, underdog, I'm used to that my whole life. But
they would just implode into a fireball if they weren't the underdogs.
But no, I think that's very true. I remember that spirit of Linux as in those early years, and you were like, man, we're catching on to something, but there was something very creative about it. I mean, I think open source in general is just lends itself to a lot of creativity just in its model. But
right.
I think we can't stifle creativity in wherever we are, even in science.
Well, so good. Now I think we've finished your story, and we can come back to what I was talking about before.
Sure.
I think the reason for that is meritocracy. Mm. I think open source is the ideal case meritocracy. Mm. That it is literally the most meritocracy in science today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I just made somebody's head explode. And I don't freaking care, because prove it, man.
Mm.
I mean, there is no, to me, technocracy and meritocracy are sometimes at odds. Not always.
Mm.
But every, one of the ways you can tell someone's a technocrat is because they claim to be part of a meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's always barriers to entry. There's barriers to entry to Linux.
Right.
They're just not that big.
Mm-hmm.
They're smaller than the other sciences. They are tiny, tiny, tiny. They're almost so small they're immeasurable. And I cannot think of another science that has lower barriers to entry. You know, literally for $21 or $29, you can pick up a Raspberry Pi and do the full, 80% superhighway model of computer science.
Right. Again, and that's just, your hardware. And then you want to get into software. Software basically for nothing. You can get that. You can learn also for nothing, right? As long as you've got an internet connection or your library, but your internet connection, whichever you've got. You've got, a means of being able to learn too.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I made a big claim, so I'm going to use a big source.
Hmm.
So got to hang out with Alan Cox back in 97.
Ah.
In one of the early days, right before Lilac started.
Yes.
And it was back when the Flat Club, and I tried to get some of the other people in the Flat Club, and I got a geek scholarship.
Hmm.
And so I went there to meet Linus, and I'm on this great pilgrimage. End up hanging out with this guy who turns out was Alan Cox. I didn't even know who he was. And that's who my counterpart was. You were like buddies for a few hours and just hung out and chatted. And,
not bad. Not
yeah,
bad.
Yeah. So turns out his home computer was a 4-way 90 megahertz Pentium Pro.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
At the time, I had a 266 megahertz Pentium 2 dual.
I remember those, yes.
My computer is faster than the guy who wrote the code for symmetric multiprocessing on Linux.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't even use my other processor if this guy didn't have that Pentium Pro 4-way.
Right.
Right? You know, that's a true meritocracy.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
It didn't matter. Really, the hardware was not a barrier. Now, there was a little bit of a barrier in that he couldn't get his hands on my hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So there is definitely technocracy in Linux, too.
Yeah.
You know, there's that kind of that blockade. We're like, oh, yes, I have this hardware. I have access to this process. I have this and that. Mm-hmm. I have these credentials. But it only buys you that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it only gives you that much of an advantage.
Right. So what do you see? You may have talked about this, and I may have missed it in some of the clips of the show. Do you see, what are the overlaps in meritocracy and technocracy versus not?
Well, so a technocracy is really just someone who's really technically adept. But the thing is, I mean, the easiest way to give an example of the terrible case of technocracy is super expensive science, like the particle smashing rings, which you're familiar with, this one at B&L.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it costs hundreds of millions and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions to build just one particle smashing ring, and they're only good at smashing certain kinds of particles.
Right.
You have to build one, different rings for different particles and different speeds and so forth.
You can't even warm your lunch up in it. All it does is...
it's a particle. Yeah, there's radiation warning signs all over the place.
Yes.
It's magnetics mainly,
right?
You know, and the particles inside the ring. So as long as you don't stand near it, you're fine. But if you stand near near it in the wrong place while it's running, yeah, right. you do the walk of shame with your little activated radiation badge.
Yeah, right.
No, I did not do that.
Right. But you are
people
right.
People in IT did.
Yeah. That's a huge barrier. Yes.
And this is a problem with scientific journals, and this is one of the reasons I'm making this claim is because there's all these experiments that are never even tried a second time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, in a lot of the sciences, you know, in chemistry, in the pharmaceuticals is a good example.
Mm.
Partly because it's so expensive, and partly because there's a disincentive from the pharmaceutical companies to let other people try it, because it's all just risk for them,
yeah.
Right?
If I
have the super drug ABZ, that's not really a super drug, but it's a super drug ABZ, and like I publish a paper and how it works and everything, and someone else wants to redo my test, because that's how real science works. You know, like here's the exact parameters on how you run this test. You run it and you verify it for yourself. Say, I verify what this guy did.
Right.
If someone actually runs that and doesn't verify it, you're in a business. Right. You know, I mean, you're done. And I realize there's some protocols in place so that doesn't happen.
Hmm.
But you know, you don't want there to be a limited number of retests. You want there to be infinite retests, because good science is always in the periphery.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying with the technocracy is it's not as bad as like oligarchy or the special case of, you know, autocracy. Autocracy is not really a threat because it can't compete with an oligarchy. But
right.
So we'll just ignore that for now.
Yeah,
and say
right.
Oligarchy.
Right.
You know, there's really like, you know, it's almost like you have oligarchy on one side and a meritocracy on the other, and technocracy is how you play for one side and pretend like you're playing for the other, or you aim for one and you inadvertently absorb some of the elements of the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to read intent into it, because I think there's a lot of people who are in this space and they're just like, they don't think about the consequences of the barriers that the siloing that they do to the science. You know, siloing is a problem everywhere, not just, how can it be a problem to every single business model but not to science business models?
That doesn't ring true. Right, you're right there.
And sometimes it doesn't have to do, again, with intent. You know, sure, sometimes people are dragging their feet and they're hoarding information. This is mine, you can't have it. But at the same time,
sometimes it's just the way things are set up.
Just the way the thing's structured.
Yeah.
You know, gold's expensive. It's hard to run experiments on gold. You know, if your experiment involves gold or silver, good luck.
You
have an immediately high cost, you know, if it's an exotic molecule or something that only exists for a microsecond.
Yes.
You know, you need a Rick ring to ring to do it, you know, a particle smashing ring to experiment on it.
Right.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does.
Does that make more sense now?
Because I've always thought about technocracy as a sort of a special, a little bit different than meritocracy. Meritocracy
it is. It's definitely different.
So there's different. Right. So the meritocracy.
They overlap for sure, but there's differences.
Right. So your meritocracy almost sort of like, you know, you get to do stuff based on your past performance. You know, whereas technocracy is a little bit more about perhaps there's a forward, more forward element to it or whatever.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, like ready, fire, aim. That's the typical IT model now for startup companies.
Right.
That inherently can't be meritous.
Mm. Right.
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 Because you're not measuring.
Mm-hmm.
Your first shot, you just shoot the dark and see if it goes ping.
Right.
You know,
let's
bang.
See what happens.
Oh, we hit it.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing meritous about that. You know, the ping might, it's just luck.
Right.
I mean, it may be an educated guess, and there's something to be said for prediction, you know, where people have externalities to whatever system they're part of, you know, where they're like, I'm not telling you how I figured out this is going to work. I just know it's going to work.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So where they're kind of building up their credibility is in prediction currency.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
Yeah.
Do you think that technocracy is something that carries a negative connotation to people? Are there people out there who are so scared of technology that they feel that they'd be excluded from somebody's technocrats are the ones who are going to take over the world? Great. You know, are there those who feel threatened by that? Because I actually think people don't realize how technically adept they really are, right? Because technology is everywhere. But, you know, I don't know what you think about that.
Well, right. So, yeah. I mean, you know, great thought experiment, time travel machine.
Mm.
If you're trying to figure out what degree you're a technocrat, right? Just imagine you going back 100 years and how easy everything would seem. Right. You might not know the terminology, but you know how things work.
Right. My cell phone might not connect, but yes.
You know, I mean, and I'm sure, like, you know, if you or like go back 200 years, you see somebody using healing disease with leeches or something, you'd be like,
excuse me.
Right. Yeah. Or not washing their hands before a surgery, you know?
Right.
And like, you're like, everybody knows this. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
But
smoking cigars in the doctor's office.
Sure. Right. Yeah. That'll help your TB. So, a lot of them kind of emulated the truth, but also you could think about it like, imagine somebody from then coming forward to now. What would they not know?
Yeah.
Pretty much everything.
So, to them,
we're technocrats already.
Right.
You know, and the thing that's interesting about this is it comes down to a lot of people have been complaining that, oh, you know, censorship is fine. A lot of people have been saying, you know, we're being censored, it's unfair. And a lot of the geeks, I think, are coming back and saying, oh, well, you know, we have to censor because otherwise bad elements will take control of our system. Mm. But we're a democracy, and, you know, on the one hand, they're not wrong because people, you can't be a democracy unless you're educated.
Right.
And unless you understand the technology, you can't really make good decisions.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, I don't have that little faith in democracy. I think democracy does work. And I think that it's just a matter of having people realize, oh, okay, I just have to be a little more of a technocrat so I actually understand what's happening.
Right.
And then I can make sane decisions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, technology completely affects politics. I mean, do we need any more evidence than 2016? It doesn't matter what your opinions were on that.
Right, because
technology was over the top as the biggest influencer of that election.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, and I mean, it's just going to, each one, so it's going to get bigger.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Countries have been mucking with each other's elections, you know, whether we think that's what happened or not, that we've been doing this for decades. And like, so someone else might be like shocked, like, you know, let's get away from the question of whether Russia did that or not.
Right.
And just go into like, okay, if you muck with another country's election, and people are, the fact that people are so outraged tells me that they don't understand computers, because you and I would sit there and watch our server logs and be like, here's an attack from Russia, here's an attack from Iran, here's an attack from China, here's an attack from Iran, here's an attack from Israel.
Right.
I thought they were the good guys. You know, here's an attack from South Africa. That's, you know, here's an attack from
New Jersey.
Here's an attack from Japan. Actually, that doesn't happen too often, but it does, right?
It could,
and you can, like, it's like a who's winning and losing in the cyber war.
Yeah.
So when, like, you know, if someone came out in the news and said, oh, you know, Russia attacked us, we're like, yeah, I knew that already.
Yeah.
You know, of course they did. We attacked them too.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we're all attacking each other.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
They, you know, so there's some technical, there's some websites that have real-time attack vector data, and they literally show it as like as if it was missiles, you know, lobbing between countries where countries are attacking each other. So if this shocks you, you're not doing your part for democracy. You are not sufficiently technocratic.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right.
I don't know if that's fair. Am I being unfair? Or are we?
Is there,
of course, everything's a curve, right? So we have to give people a chance to catch up and go, oh, wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
Right.
That we've been looking at these logs the whole time for 30 years and like, yeah, okay, I knew that.
Right. Yeah, but the information is out there. Right? People are exposed to so much information all the time and need to have the wherewithal to learn how to be critical of the information that they see and then process it and move on. I mean, this is, again, in technology, we do this all the time.
Right.
I think this is a skill that that young people need to have as well. Be skeptical of what you're seeing, but also you know, build on your knowledge as you go along, and don't just think, well, you know, the secret to life is just having a fast car and just, you know, having a great job.
Not.
Because
it does feel really good to have a fast car, especially when all the other ones are slow.
Right. Especially when
it's a sleeper and no one knows it's coming. Oh, so good. Light turns green. What? You're gone. I had somebody clap for me once.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he thought he was going to cut in front of me in the light. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh, you don't know what this car is, do you? You know, light changes. What? You know, you guys have the supercharger, right? You know, the supercharger wine for the guys, for the techies out there.
Uh-huh.
And he was just like, he nailed it. And he had a pretty fast car, but it was, you know, he didn't know. And I mean, I just cut in front of him, and he was just like, what? No! He's clapping for me! Yeah!
Meanwhile,
yeah, he was gonna, you know, it might have been, if I had won by less, it might have been less macho, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. It's funny.
Well, I hope he learned from that experience.
Yes. There's a lesson to learn there. You don't judge a book by its cover.
Right. <Yeah.
laughs>
Good.
I almost want to make a commitment to always have my fastest car be look like it isn't.
Like
yeah.
Computers.
Yeah.
Yeah, the old school like off-white cases and stuff.
Oh yeah, like the faded yellow beige case.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
Well, the AT standard hasn't. So in case you don't know, the standard for computer cases has been the same since the 80s.
That's
you
right.
could actually be running, you know, bring a. I guess if you went to a LAN party, right, you show up with the beige case. You're like, this guy's gonna be. What's this ping gonna be? This is gonna be awful. You know.
Do they still do?
Modding now.
Yeah.
Like to do a lot of routing and stuff.
Yeah.
Are LAN parties still a thing? I don't know if that's...
No, why?
Because, you know...
Everyone's got Fios and cable.
Right,
you know, everyone's got high-end broadband, so...
Because, you know, you bring that up and I...
What?
I like LAN parties.
I do, too. We've kicked around the idea of having one in the user group, but we haven't actually...
Yeah.
I guess there's not enough gamers, like, to get a commitment for... We might actually have a lower turnout that meeting. I don't want to do that, you know?
But we... I mean, I guess maybe, again, because people are so exposed to this in their jobs, but we use LAN parties also as a learning experience about, you know, hacking, about networking, because some of us, myself included, really didn't understand all the principles of networking, and so a LAN party helped you to understand that. It was a good teaching experience, too.
Well, a lot of people, I think, still don't understand the principles of networking, but now it's easier because, you know, things are kind of automatic between DHCP, you know, and Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi especially, right?
Yeah, they just don't get what's actually happening underneath.
Right.
And, you know, it's fine until it breaks.
Yes.
And then it's a total nightmare.
Right.
Right, and it takes over your life, and you're calling your friends. You know, you're calling us. Help me.
Oh, yes.
You know, I don't know what's going on. I can't connect to the internet anymore on this computer, and just this one.
And it's always fun messing with those people because a lot of them don't understand when you come in and say, oh, of course, it's your flux capacitor. That's the problem. And they'll be like, oh, is it really?
It's
well,
your muffler
you.
Bearings.
Yes.
Would you like speaking of muffler bearings, would you like some wine?
Oh,
red?
What do you have on tap tonight?
I have no idea. I don't know anything about wine, although I'm pretty sure when the show is done, I will.
Oh. this looks like a very fine vintage here.
Okay, great.
That's good. So would you like some as well?
Yeah, sure.
All
okay.
Right, good.
Let us celebrate.
Technology. So there's a technology.
It broke.
Oh, my God.
because the wine wasn't kept, you know, you have to keep wine. So that the cork stays wet, right? So.
Yeah. Okay. I know.
However, this could be an opportunity.
It's becoming a reoccurring stick. Here you go.
Oh, okay. Well,
I had a backup.
That's good. See, again, the sysop. You understood what you needed to do, right? So, yes. There you go.
Sorry. No what? No red.
That's all right. We'll see how this works.
I think you know what. Every time it's been that bottle. It's cursed. That's the fourth quirk. So I give up. I'll just drink it at home, and we'll bring a new bottle.
Right. I guess we'll bring in the right corkscrew. Right. Well,
cheers. Sorry about
cheers.
No red.
Cheers, Matt N.
Cheers, Matt S.
All right.
Yeah, we had this name collision problem because we emailed each other privately about what was going on with the group.
Right, and I was the secretary.
And I know who I was, and you knew who you were.
Right.
But no one else knew which Matt was which, so
right.
We had to, yeah.
Good times.
Which Matt was talking. I don't understand. Wow, that was really very insightful. I'm really glad to hear about your background. It's very helpful for STEM in general. I'm thinking about doing a cartoon about the two cartoons I'm thinking about doing are one about the web 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 kind of and the differences.
Uh-huh.
And another one I'm thinking about doing is about the meritocracy. And, you know, I really think it's what is a meritocracy? People don't even know what it is.
I think that would be excellent.
And it's absolutely critical to democracy, I think, to the, you know, whether it's a republic or whatever kind of democracy you want it to be.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can't really, I don't think you can live in a technocracy and have it be a democracy without promoting meritocracy on a regular basis.
Right.
Say that five times fast.
That's a tough one.
You get all that, right? You taking notes? Yeah, okay.
Steve's good. He's got it all under control back there.
No. What's it for Steve? Knows. He's a technocrat. On his episode, we already figured out he's a technocrat.
Oh, okay, good. I didn't get to watch all of his episodes.
The software that he's using, he's in a band.
Yes.
That's across. I've never heard of this before. It's kind of an arc. You got an archetype, dude. Yeah.
That's one of our EPs, the archetype.
Oh, nice.
See that?
Nice. Yeah. See, this is the kind of genre writing stuff I expect from a world changing band.
Right. There
yeah.
we go.
So
there
you know, their band is scattered across continents.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So it's not even like there's no local basis for the band.
Nice.
So
yeah, I'll spend money to go meet up and go on tour.
Yeah. That's great. How far can we sink ourselves in the hole before regret overtakes joy? Yeah, no, I hope that's not the way it goes. And actually, I think that's a huge problem because, you know, what's the point of the sorting mechanisms of being part of a broader society? I mean, you know, a lot of people would argue that copyright reform, you know, a lot of the copyright laws that they're trying to pass are trying to even out the playing field between countries. But generally speaking, they just disincentivize artists more. I mean, have you guys done a lot of original work? Or are you guys, yeah, I know you're in bands.
Yeah, you know what? It's sad to say, I wish I were more creative in music myself. And I have never really been in bands that were that did original music, not much at all. So I'm more of the cover scene. So you know, but you know, there's a lot of fun in that. But I do know some guys who are doing some excellent original music right now on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of bands, a prog rock band does very well in Nassau County, and another friend of mine who's seeing the world in an original band. So but for myself, unfortunately, no. Yeah.
Well, so I think some of it's there's a few things to it. It isn't necessarily that you can't, you know, be in, you know, if you met up with the right group of musicians. So
yeah,
that.
At the right time of life too, because as you get older, it's
right place,
it's,
right time.
Yes, yeah.
You know, right time of life.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you know, like it's just this. You need feedback, so you need to be putting original material out there. It doesn't have to all be original, but there needs to be some original feedback.
Right.
And then going back into the band and making you change your ideas. Mm. Doesn't have to be a ton of it. There's been bands that have been wildly successful with very little feedback, but just in that band, not in their whole careers.
Right. Yeah,
there's always at least a couple members of successful bands that have been had some feedback from audiences and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, and so I think that's some of it, and some of it is... Also, the risk-taking, too. I mean, some of it is, you know, like... Mm. And, you know, I guess there's only so many risks you can take with your life.
Yes.
You know, right? Yes. So, I mean, you know, like, if you have a cover band that's bringing in money, you know...
Right.
I mean, I know quite a few musicians who have been in just cover bands that are highly respected.
Right.
You know.
Oh yeah, I've played with guys who were just
everyone's like that guy's the best.
Cool cover bands are not usually well respected.
Yeah, exactly. So like, it isn't necessarily that, and even like, I think people can see that the creativity inside of them, they just never found that niche.
Right.
So I think some of it's luck.
Right.
And I mean, someone compared it to, I forget who it was, somebody compared it to brain surgery. You know, rock and roll is like brain surgery. You really have to be at that level of specialization also. So there's an element of luck, and there's also that level of specialization of knowing exactly what the audience needs at that time.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, and as we always say, the scene also, right? Does the music scene in your particular, you know, neighborhood or where you live, you know, want to have it too?
Right. The music scene used to be phenomenal in New York 20, 30 years ago, and it's really not that good anymore.
I'm sad to say, although we do have our pockets of, you know, you get
it's not the musician's fault, you know.
Right, absolutely not, yeah.
I mean, part of it is also, you know, just younger people are not, you know, I think that the payphone generation is still willing to go out to go to clubs, but the younger generations, they kind of want, they don't want to be away from what's happening on the internet for very long.
Right.
You know, I have an advantage with this show because I'm young enough to understand that, but old enough not to care. You know, I mean, like, there could be a nuclear war going on out there right now, and I would have no clue. Some people could not live with their phone not being on the table and watching it the whole time while we're talking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you've noticed we've kept our phones off to the side.
Right, I didn't even think about it. I'm only bringing it up as a rhetorical rhetorical thing. I don't care. I mean, yes, I will be glued to my phone sometimes. I have been mocked for that.
You gotta use it for work too. I mean, you can do business deals on the toilet thanks to our phones.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Or business deals during other private enterprises. You know.
You never know.
Great. Just be careful what autofill does.
Great job last night, Steve. Oh, yes. Thank you. Oh, the business deal.
Oh, sorry. Wrong person I'm texting. Yes. Right. Yeah. 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 Right, I've had a few hilarious misspellings and wrong. Yeah, I'm pretty paranoid. It's kept me alive. It's funny because I used to think I was so paranoid in the 80s and the early 90s. Yeah, you are. Yeah. In the 80s and the early 90s. Yeah. And now all that fear is completely justified.
Right.
Because of how the tech world is and how, I mean, everything you do is out there forever.
Right.
So what do you think about that? Transparent society. Do you think that the cameras are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that trend's going to continue? And is it a good or a bad thing?
You know, I wonder about that. And I relate that to just open source in general, right? The model of the cathedral versus the bazaar, right? Why we want to have open source and exposing bugs and having things being very transparent for a programmer, right?
Right.
So now does that correspond to life? I'm not really sure. I mean, part of me says, you know, it's an intrusion of privacy that we have these cameras everywhere, and whether we agree or not with red light cameras and stuff, but even just the fact that, hey, you're doing Google Earth and, oh, look, that's me. You know, I was walking that neighborhood in Cleveland and here I am.
Yeah. Right. Forever on that
forever,
street. You're on that street for 3 years now until they update the map.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so there's definitely that, but
There's been some great people will go around hunting for weird candid moments, and there's been some great
ones. I've seen some good.
I think it was a guy running from a bear in one of them.
Yeah.
There's a guy running from a bear on Google Earth in one of the iterations, or running after a bear with a bat or something like that. And you know, there's been some compromising positions, and now they auto blur people.
Yeah.
So,
but transparency. I mean, you have transparency in government, right? I have a friend of mine who works for the NSA, and I'm sure he's got his particular, you know, opinions on that, but
now they're going to shut us off. Thanks, Matt.
Well, not my friend. He's good, but the other guys. Well, yes, but I think about these things. You know, I think it's a spectrum. I think, you know, we have to find the happy medium where it should be. I think we got to lean more towards transparency than not. But I think there comes a point where you can't be.
So covered. I had an idea. Mm. One of the things I love about the show is I get to talk to some of the smartest minds and like bounce my ideas off of them, and they can bounce their ideas with me, and I think I have a little bit of an idea. So I'm full transparent society, but I think that we have a natural human right to property. Now, you can argue about where that property right ends and starts, but we definitely need some kind of property, because property gives us an ability to have autonomy. If you don't have any property, you can't plan your own time.
Mm.
You can't plan your own resources. You can't plan your own investment.
Right.
You know, you can argue about which properties we're talking about, but there has to be some kind of property at some point.
Mm.
I mean, otherwise, you don't know where your next meal is coming from.
Mm. I get that. You know, it's interesting. I don't know very much about this, but didn't Native Americans not believe in property? Like, everything was shared. Nobody owned land or anything.
Yes. So there was it was just community property.
Just community,
you're correct.
Yeah.
Well, remember, so one of the things, so this is, I don't know this, and this is the kind of thing I don't think I can know without a big research grant, but there's
Send
also
your money, folks.
There's also stories about Indians. If there was a terminally selfish Indian, they would excise them from the tribe. Get out. We don't want you here.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, who does that remind you of? What player in society is that? You know, that's typically the psychopath that acts like that.
Yes.
So there's some question in my mind about whether they had successfully excised psychopaths from their ranks, which is kind of interesting when you look at it. Now, you know, people might be like, oh, he's on psychopaths again. But it isn't actually all so bad for psychopaths, because, of course, if you remember, the Indians were decimated when the Westerners came, when the Europeans came and invaded, essentially.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it was not much of an invasion, because most of the Indians died from disease.
That is true also.
Yeah, probably could have put up a good fight if it wasn't for that.
Mm.
But let's suppose that wasn't the prevalent factor. Mm. And let's suppose that they could have, I mean, they did have the home turf advantage, right?
Yeah.
And of course, once they had established themselves on the coast, you know, the western half of the country, the Wild West, horses and guns were already part of the Indian culture at that point.
I was going to actually bring up the technology angle, right?
Did so the horses and the guns were the big thing. They didn't have horses before, you know, they came, and the weapons. Mm. But I think the real problem is they didn't have psychopaths. And I could actually point to the Vikings, and they're I think the Vikings were a psychopathic cooperative, and I think having, you know, what happens is you kind of get into this kind of almost idyllic mindset where you don't have to hoard resources at all.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily want to be in a situation where you have to hoard every resource all the time, or that when you can't even invest in anything because somebody could just come along and pluck it from your hands and take it from you.
Right, right.
And on the other hand, you can get into a situation where you don't want to get into a situation where you know, everything's community property, because then you have no reserves. You know, like as an example in our modern society, look at the just-in-time system, just-in-time manufacturing system, where people are manufacturing just enough stuff to keep the supply, the trucks filled, and the store shelves filled, but there's no warehouse in between.
Right.
They're just counting on better integration with the information technology. That's not shockproof.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, the Northeast blackout almost plunged New York City into chaos because we only had a week's supply of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people, there was kind of jokes going around that every city's 3 days from chaos.
Yeah.
No, it was a week.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It was a week and 3 days.
Mm.
So at the week, the gasoline started flowing in again.
Mm.
But while that gasoline flow was interrupted, things were getting progressively worse day by day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so... And that's just an example of what I'm talking about having... So when you have community property, there's no reason to hoard ever. You don't want to hoard too much,
right?
But you don't want to hoard too little either. You need to be able to invest. And being able to hoard to some degree gives you the ability to invest. And that, in turn, is that behavior, which is a unique human behavior, I think, is kind of the basis for the right to property.
Right, right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So, so the cool thing about having a right to property is it actually solves the transparent society problem, where people are like, oh, I have a right to privacy. And, like, why do people think that?
Mm.
And I think that they're not necessarily wrong, because the place that you have a right to privacy is within the bounds of your own property.
Right, right.
If you tie privacy to property, you solve two problems. You solve the desire to go completely propertyless and just have community property, which can create supply shocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be completely unintended. It doesn't have to be from a invading civilization or anything. It could just be nature.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been some nature surprises. We do not have weather-licked.
Yeah.
You know,
true.
Try placing bets every day on the weather report. It's going to be wrong sometimes.
Even just this month
if you think
of
it's
May,
perfect.
Right? Who would expect
I would never have guessed that it was going to be so rainy and cold.
Yeah.
And, like, you know... And the thing is, it's not like some models predict it, some models don't. It's not a hard science yet.
Right.
You know, it's not like we know what it's going to be a month from now.
Right.
You know, so you can have forecasts. I'm not saying that, and they may have reasonable error rates, but there are error rates for sure.
Absolutely.
So there can be, you know, we can have a solar storm. There is no scientist I know of that will say, I know when the next Carrington event will be.
Hmm.
You know, we don't know how it works.
Right.
A Carrington event could fry the sun-facing side of the Earth and all of its electrical connections.
Right.
You know, if you haven't hoarded supplies, just a little bit. You don't have to go crazy.
Right.
You don't have to build a rice fort around your house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, like, if you don't have, like, 3 days of rice and beans in your cupboard, you're not being realistic to how society works. Or you're sure as hell didn't live through Sandy, that's for sure.
Right, right.
I mean, and then people were like, oh, you're crazy. You know, I was lending stuff out to people. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was generous because I could be.
Yeah,
I could afford to be. But that doesn't... Somebody at some point had to hoard for that to be able to happen.
Yeah, yeah. How long were you out power-wise?
So we were... That's the thing. Mm-hmm. I actually was trying to give my generator away because I had this great generator and we needed it for one day.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually our poles are supply electricity electricity to Long Island Railroad where we are.
Oh, okay.
So they had to get that up first.
Yeah.
So because they need to get the trains working because, right. Of course, you know, I don't know if you try to drive into the city the next day.
No, actually, we got lucky because that's when our office for the company I work for closed that weekend, and then Sandy came. It was Monday or Tuesday.
Get out of here.
Yeah, no, we just got very lucky.
Astrologers are going to the papers. Who is this guy?
It was just a stroke of luck because who would have wanted to have been in Lower Manhattan when that was going on? No, yeah.
Yeah, so I walked the bridge that day.
Yeah, wow.
So I called. Yeah, I'm telling you, I called it. I called it. I told them, I'm like, your secondary server room is going to be in the water. Mm. And they're like, yeah, sure, whatever, Matt. Yeah. Wow. Not only, obviously, I was the only person who was considering this kind of disaster at that level because I was one of the few people who showed up that wasn't a manager that day.
Yeah.
So, you know, like that tells you right there that everybody else was home busy bailing their own problems out.
Right. Well, my bad luck was that.
You know, everything, we were ready. Everything was like, all right, sure, put a log in the fireplace. Yeah. Run the generator, you know, move all the food to one fridge, and we were good.
Right. We were out 2 weeks I think it was like 13 days in my neighborhood. It just, bad luck with communication with LIPA and different things, and we just didn't get our power restored. So we went from being, working in that office to having the office closed down, and we all became remote workers. So for 2 weeks, I couldn't remote work because we had no power, no internet. So, thankfully,
you're in the backyard beating leopard hides.
Yes.
Sorry. Trying to lay them out in the sun.
Right.
Ah, the sun god is angry.
Yeah, that was very strange. Well, thanks to my sister, though, who worked in an office that they had office space to spare, kind of like, you know, a place like this, I was able to work the second week in a, you know, remote office, and the power came back. But that was crazy. And, you know, having some supplies on hand was good until, you know, you can't store hot water very long. But so
right.
You know, that was because it was cold, too. That happened in October, right? Mm-hmm. It was in October. And
it snowed the day after Sandy.
Yeah. Well,
you know, if you weren't here, you didn't know. So
yeah,
the day after Sandy, it was...
For Halloween, they delayed it to a Monday.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the atmosphere dislocation was so large that it snowed on you know, yeah.
Yeah.
It was nuts. Yeah. So, but that was a good example. Everyone in New York's been through that. So, at least if you're a local listener, you kind of get what I'm talking about having supply disruptions and you know, and the importance of property, and then the whole privacy thing is solved, you know, and then it becomes a natural kind of back and forth, you know. I mean, I always want to find those equilibriums where things will naturally kind of putter along until people understand them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's one of the geniuses of our government as it was set up, and of course, as time, it gets less genius,
right?
As technology changes us, mm-hmm. it changes our society, and changes our.
But we need to adapt, right? And democracy allows us to adapt to a point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, the adapting's slow, but you know, things kind of chug along while we're sorting out what to do next.
Right. True.
Yeah. And, you know, so I don't want to say I stopped worrying and I love the bomb, but I kind of do.
Yes.
You know, I kind of, Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove, yeah.
If you haven't seen it, go watch it.
A great, great movie,
All right, so let me just, since you're in the biometric business, what do you think about biometric anonymizing, you know, de-identifying.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Part of that is part of what we have to do as data scientists, as people who deal with you know, human information. We have HIPAA privacy laws, right? So there is some amount of de-identification that has to happen for data that we store. Or on the flip side of that is, well, we shouldn't be looking at personal and private information on computer systems. I've worked not only for companies like I do now with health information, but financial information, company financial information, right? So there are those who have that position of power that if you're a database administrator, for example, you have access to everything. Right? So
what was your database, what was your DBA specialty back in the...
So let's see. So I start, when I actually was at Brookhaven and I made the switch from chemistry to IT, I ended up in a group that we wrote programs for our division and possibly for the lab, and client, we also ran databases. So I learned Oracle databases at Brookhaven and just fell into it, loved it, and so became a database administrator and a little bit of a programmer, web design and so forth. So I worked with Oracle for a long time, and then when I switched from Brookhaven to Reuters, I learned Oracle's core product for companies, Oracle applications, right? So you run your HR system, you run your financials on Oracle's platform. So,
right.
So that's where, you know, my Oracle-ness sort of...
Oracle. So I was talking about Java a few shows ago, and Oracle's the company that bought Sun Microsystems and subsequently Java. So they're the ones changing the license on Java, which fortunately had forked into OpenJDK. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're kind of like, we're not totally screwed. But you, again, if you have a business relationship with, if you have a business that depends on code that's written in Java, you should probably recheck that license. Have your lawyers.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So keep going.
You know, running databases and understanding database architecture and how you can back up and recover a database and keep your company running. So all of that stuff, and you know, companies run on databases. I mean, it's so important for every company. So that's I got my start on that, learning stuff at Brookhaven, and then transferring that into what I did at Reuters. So
how was the atmosphere at Reuters? Was it crazy, or
you know, it was fun because this was all before 9/11. So there was a lot of business travel. I got a chance to travel to Europe a few times for business trips to London, to Paris, and all, because travel was just free and easy, you know.
Wait.
It was
wonderful.
Nice. Yes, we love to do that. Yes.
No, I need more wine.
This is because in the news what happened with Notre Dame and the fire. I was in Paris in 2000. There was an Oracle user conference, and I said to my boss, "Oh, I'd love to go to this user conference, but it's in Paris." And at the time, we're like, "Well, we have the budget for it. It's good. Go to the conference in Paris, right? Easy."
Right.
And there was no TSA or anything. It was very easy to get on the plane and go. Mm-hmm. And so I had a chance to see Paris. I had a chance to go into the cathedral and all. And
it must have killed you to see. Well, you're a Catholic, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah. So to see that church in flames and being paralyzed and saying, "Why aren't they doing anything?" And then you realize, oh, it's on a little island, and you know you can't get water to the cathedral quick enough, you know. So,
right. It's made of wood.
Yeah. That's right.
Oh, very old. So I mean, you lost twice. So my argument when that came up on the show was, and I still stick by it, which is that, that regardless of what religion or what organization that belonged to, because it was so early and so different than anything humanity had ever done, that belonged to human beings.
Yeah.
And that's really important because, like, I mean, it doesn't matter what your faith, your interests, your discipline is.
Right.
You walk into there and you're like, people did this with hand tools?
Right.
You know?
Right. I would have felt the same way if I saw the Taj Mahal on fire.
Right.
Would have been
like
this is a, you know, a cultural landmark.
I am sure there must be tens of thousands, at least, if not hundreds of thousands of people that walked into there and just went, I can do whatever this thing I'm trying to do is.
And some
of it may have been important to all of us.
Right.
You know?
One, go.
Okay, I think we're back.
Was that a time warp? What happened? Is there yet? Where are we?
What happened? I just heard this thunder, and then Steve turned to dust. I had to go to start the podcast.
Poor
back
Steve.
Up.
Yeah.
All right, whoa, no spoilers. Gotta be careful with the spoilers.
That's a year old.
Okay, yeah, that's a year old. You're right. Yeah. So anyway, we were talking about Notre Dame.
Yeah.
So where were we?
And we're talking about the cathedral burning, and also about perhaps
that's what the Catholic Church's reaction was.
Yeah, and I think to understand, I have to understand this myself. The Catholic Church doesn't own the cathedral, right? In fact, the city of Paris actually owns the cathedral. So there's a, you know, as a cultural icon, as a cathedral, as something that, you know, represents
the faith. Obviously, whatever their equivalent of a historic landmark designation is applies.
There's you know, beautiful works of art that were in there and things and some relics as well. Which
so dude ran in and saved the crown of thorns.
Yes.
Which is, if you're not Christian, that's like super important. That was the crown that Jesus was wearing. wearing whenever you see him iconified as crucified.
Right. So there's that aspect of it as well. But I think the interesting thing, and if you understand the topic of ecclesiology, which is the study of theology of the church, then you understand that, you know, the church building isn't the church. And you've heard some people talk about this too, that, you know, even if the thing burned to the ground, it's a shame. We've lost a cultural icon, but the church continues, the people, right?
Ragnarok, spoiler, is Asgard is not a place, it's a people.
Right.
It's a pop culture cross-reference.
Right. So,
in case all those big words hurt you.
Yeah, right.
You know a lot of religious big words.
Religious? Oh, I can throw a whole bunch of them around. Yes, I actually have a degree.
You have a degree?
I do. I have a master's degree in theology. Yes,
really?
Yes.
That's spectacular. I've actually thought about getting a degree in philosophy, so I guess that would be another similar route.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, and you have a degree in theology, huh?
Yeah, I do, yes. I actually went, as you mentioned, I am a Catholic. I'm a Catholic deacon, right? So not only am I a scientist and a mathematician and a computer guy, but I'm also a clergy.
Wow, yeah. And I didn't burst into flame? This is great. No, I'm just kidding. I'm on my church council in my church. Yeah. And by the way, just for the record, and I've mentioned this here before, is I'm perfectly capable of discussing anything as a strict atheist or a Christian. So if somebody says, oh, that's way too Christian perspective, right, I can defend the same exact thing from a completely non-religious. I use it as I use my religion as my faith as kind of like as a guide map, mm-hmm, and then I try to resolve a lot of the things in my faith. And I, you know, some people might call this born again, but it's not. I never really wavered my faith. What I did was I kind of checksummed it. Mm-hmm. I went through and I looked at every piece of it and I said, okay, how does this normalize with the observations I make in our world?
Right.
Realistic down to earth observations, you know, things that I see that I can repeat, that I can explain, that I understand, and how can I relate that back to like the philosophy of having a religious faith?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's helped me a lot with the Civ Gene stuff too, because it helped me to understand faith is just knowing something you can't prove.
Mm-hmm. That's a good sort of a beginning.
Yeah. I mean, I'm waiting, please, if you could disprove that statement, mm-hmm, I'd love to hear it.
Right. And, you know, as scientists, as people who study math and all, that's actually true in the sciences as well, because while eventually you can find a paper that proves Pythagorean's theorem, sometimes you prove the theorem in math class, but sometimes you don't have time. You have to take some of the, you know, the gravitational constant. You take all these things on faith, too, even in science, because you don't have time to prove them. You just assume somebody else did, or it just sort of
works. Well, I would even take that one step further, because I'm a little further ahead of you on this particular curve, which is that actually all science starts as faith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the interesting thing. So faith doesn't have to be, faith can be supernatural,
right,
or it can be provable, mm-hmm, but it's still faith. It doesn't make a difference.
Right.
It's still the same exact psychological mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that one has an end where you can use your rational mind to work through the steps and say, okay, this is how I could prove that is true.
Right.
And the other one, you may not be able to prove it true, but you also may not be able to prove that it's untrue.
Right.
In which case, it would be kind of a supernatural faith where you go, okay, I don't know how this works, but I know it's true.
Right. And it's
it keeps demonstrating itself to me.
Right. And it's supernatural, so it actually falls outside of the realm of our natural means of measurement.
Right. A lot of people get mad at the idea of supernatural. And it's like, no, science just ignores it. It doesn't care about supernatural.
Right. It has its questions that it solves, and solves very well. I mean, I like to use myself as an example of somebody who's, yes, you know, I have a religious faith, but I'm also a heavy-duty scientist, right? For the last couple of hours, we've talked about all sorts of technology things and everything else, and I truly believe them. I think they're very important.
Right.
And in my faith, perhaps you believe the same, you know, God gave us a brain to use, not just to sit there and say, okay, yeah, that's true. You know,
there's probably a more generic way to say this. So, mm-hmm, as a Christian, mm-hmm, the way that I function in an atheist discipline, right? You know, and this is the differentiating here from atheists and anti-theists. There's a group of people who think that religion that religion damages society.
Right.
And I think that the foundation for that thinking is very weak.
Mm-hmm.
But atheism is completely different. Atheism just ignores religion. Whatever, I don't care. Stop. Worst case, stop annoying me with this. I don't care about it.
Right. Right.
You know. But so for me, you know, the way that I was able to marry those two worlds is it's just the faith, Christian faith specifically for me, is the works. The man and the word in that order, mm-hmm. and I'm not dissing on scripture, mm-hmm. but I think that the point of the thing that's interesting about Christianity specifically is that because it originated in another religion that was very much scripture based, mm-hmm. you know, Judaism.
Yes,
and it kind of like almost like okay, you guys just can't get this right no matter how many instructions I give you, mm-hmm. right? You know, like imagine you know, so I'm just going to give you an example, and you can emulate that, mm-hmm. and then that's what sending a god in a human form was to the planet. Mm-hmm. This could theoretically work for a number of different faiths. It doesn't have to be Christianity, but mm-hmm. this mechanism right. of looking at the things that are around me, all the repeatable observations, all the things, you know, human example of what God would do if had the human limitations, mm-hmm. and then anything that doesn't fall into those gets filled in by Scripture. Mm-hmm. Gives you the ability to have a supernatural faith and be able to think completely in the atheist space at exactly the same time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's where you are.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. I guess I've approached it perhaps a little bit differently, and in helping young people understand Christian faith as part of what I do, and young people who are so perhaps overexposed to STEM and not exposed enough to philosophy. And I actually didn't take any philosophy classes in college. I was afraid of it, right? So when I entered into a formation program to become a Catholic deacon, you know, we kind of got a little bit of philosophy mixed in with our theology, and I wish I had actually studied philosophy more, because it would have been easier to grasp some of the concepts of theology.
Oh, okay, cool. That's kind of a cool callback to what I was saying before.
Yeah, so you have, I feel that you have science, and then the questions that science can't answer, philosophy starts to fill that void, right? And then, of course, we have, we believe, you know, that when you have theology.
I call it the periphery. That's what, you know, like, you can usually represent it on an actual graph as the outliers.
Yeah, yes.
You know, right. You know, whenever you get outliers, like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Mm. You know, from a scientific point of view, it's an error. Mm-hmm. From a philosophical point of view, it's a possibility.
Yeah.
From a faith point of view, you know, it could even be a proof.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, I think proof is probably pushing it. You know?
Yeah.
It can be a proof for you, but it can't be. Faith has to be personal. Each person has to have their own faith.
Right. Right.
You know, you can have an organization of people with like-minded faiths, mm-hmm. but you can't give a person a faith. You can't lead the horse to water, right?
Right.
Right. Like I talked with Arnie about you know, well, what if black holes are wormholes? Mm. What if they're just bridges between two points in space?
Yeah.
And that would explain all the behaviors we're seeing, mm-hmm. you know. And it's kind of a faith of mine, right? It's a scientific faith, it's a provable faith. Right. Theoretically, if you had a spaceship, you could go, okay, kamikaze, and fly into it, and when you're not ripped apart and you end up in another part of space, I was right.
Right.
Of course, we can't go back through it. We didn't know that about it, but you know, but like, you know, like, it is a theoretically a provable faith. So, anyway, that's a little bit off the edge, but you know, I actually think that, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about this. So I've been toying with the idea that a lot of fundamentalist religions, and when I say fundamentalist, stop me if you disagree, I think fundamentalist religions are very rule-based religions, right? You know, mm-hmm. ones that turn to scripture for most or all things,
right.
Like first, right? And I'm not talking about, you know, as a record of things that happen, but instead as a framework for rules, you know, as a rule set instead of a framework for understanding, mm-hmm. a conceptual framework, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that context where there's so much, especially if the religion is dualist, where there's this conflicting scripts, I'm using that word intentionally, you know, that it's kind of a technocracy. The theocracy is inherently a technocracy. Theocracy is a religious government, if you don't know what a theocracy is.
Right.
You know, and that if you're the priests or the religious heads, rabbis or whatever it is,
or whatever,
are the technocrats.
Yeah.
And the theocracy is a pure technocracy. So if you want to know what a pure technocracy looks like,
it's interesting, right? Yeah.
Because there's really, you know, merit. There is merit, right? You know, but the merit is your ability to work within the technical confines.
Yes. Right.
Right.
Understand.
I mean, it doesn't. This is important. I mean, even if you hate religion, it's important you understand this stuff because. I mean, like, you know, like understanding the Reformation without knowing not just about Gutenberg and his printing press, but understanding the arguments that were being made on either side of the Lutherans and the Catholic Church. Don't worry, we're not going to reenact it here.
Right.
We're not going to go to medieval Europe here, I don't think, right?
Right.
So, but we're not the historical reenactment committee, but, understanding that are those arguments, you know, that originally Martin Luther was making as a Catholic monk, and then eventually turned into a big fight between him and the church, and then, you know, you saw the politics of the time and how the church was, you know, playing political roles.
Yes.
Understanding all that is impossible if you, like, at least look at this stuff.
Yes, right. It's
and so I figured out a lesson about this. This is something I've been wanting to say, and I haven't had a chance to say it. I think that there's a warning in the Reformation, and what happened was the Catholic Church had one view, and they were saying the opposite view. They were in practice, they were being more restrictive, and they were arguing for freedom of thought. And Martin Luther and his cronies, his team, let's call my whole religion cronies, his team were arguing for a very restrictive kind of point of view, like you don't have any choices. But in practice, they were literally trying to break away from a very authoritarian organization.
Right.
So I think at that point, it's an object lesson. It's almost a base case. And this is something that happens in religion a lot. Like, can God make a rock he can't move?
Right.
You know, that's an archetype. If you can't understand that concept, you know, can an administrator create a program he can't manage? Code.
Right.
You know?
And administrators are gods, by the way.
Yeah. they are effectively gods, especially in Unix. Right? But so that when you have two sides doing one thing and saying the opposite thing, and they're both doing that, it's an inevitability that they're going to go to war.
Right.
And I think that's a big sign. It's such a great, clear-cut case of that, that you can apply it to future events and see, okay, they're doing one thing and saying another, and both sides are doing it. And that when that happens, the only resolution is going to be war, because the population is just completely bamboozled at that point.
They can't
even participate in the argument anymore, because they're waving the flag for one thing and they're actually saying another.
Right. And it's interesting at that period of time, because I think the general population wasn't educated enough. The technology of spreading news wasn't enough, so that the only ones who really knew this battle was going on, I believe, were those who are directly connected with the church, right?
It was just Germany and the church. The religious component of Germany and the church at that point.
It would be so different today if that happened, and think about it.
5 minutes into it, they would be on Twitter and everyone would be yelling at each other.
Right. But actually, we actually studied that in you know, my Catholic class of church history about the Reformation. Very interesting. Number one, Martin Luther was right about a lot of stuff, and some of those things actually came to pass after the Catholic Church said, you know what, maybe he was right. So,
He was a Catholic monk just trying to reform it from the inside.
Yeah, and there were definitely reforms that he proposed.
Another warning about whistleblowers and not supporting them.
Right, absolutely. And also the church ignored him. The Catholic Catholic Church ignored him for a while, thinking he was just another pest that he would go away, and that allowed him to build momentum. So it's very interesting, and also interesting what happened, because it paralyzed the Catholic Church for about 500 years, their Counter-Reformation, with what happened, and
right.
what only was basically resolved, getting back to the year that I was born, Vatican II was going on at that time, and so finally there was the cracks in the ice that came 500 years earlier because of the Council of Trent.
I mean, I know it seems slow, but it must be very exciting to be a Catholic right now, because there's so many changes happening.
It is, right? I mean, it really is, and part of that is this movement called ecumenism, right, an interfaith, where we say, hey, our brothers and sisters may believe other things, but we're all still here together, and we want to find our common ground, and we want to learn about each other and get along. So
in case you're wondering why I brought this up, I wanted to talk a little bit about faith on the Technocrat specifically, because there's a lot of people, really there's people from every race, creed, and color, and every sex in IT.
Yes.
And it really is just about intelligence in our field. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You can argue about the knack or not, but you also have to have intelligence for sure.
Yes.
To succeed long term, you have to.
Yes.
You can kind of weasel your way through it for a few months or years.
Right.
But,
the Peter Principle catches up with everybody.
Right. The Peter Principle will catch up with you, especially in this field, more so than others, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't understand the concept, you're going to burn your IT department down.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'll just burn it down just because. Mm-hmm. So the thing that's interesting is that some faiths, restrict the kind of work you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things about IT is really there's nothing restricting you from being in IT in nearly any faith. As far as I know, any.
Right.
Maybe I'm wrong, but Amish.
The
Mennonites.
Yeah,
the Mennonites can't do computers. But other than that,
right.
Or like a highly classical kind of, I don't know what the word for that is. I guess Luddite?
A Luddite religion. Maybe, yes. Yeah.
I'm a little Luddite, but I mostly kid. I think it's fixable, or I wouldn't have the show. I'd be in a cabin in the woods.
Right.
I think people just need to think about this stuff and go, okay.
Right.
But so, you can't really talk about society in IT, and especially because open source is like the best case for science.
Yes.
And you have this happening simultaneously, alongside this field that has all these different religions in it, that may have completely contrary, maybe even incompatible in some cases.
Right.
Especially if they're highly fundamentalist and they have really strict rules, and they may just collide with each other.
Right. But yet we still have to get along. We still have to live on this planet, and we still have to solve the problems of the world and use technology to do so.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
and pushing forward on intelligent solutions, I think, is part of it. There's answers here for broader society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's I guess where I'm going with
this. I think that's
a lot of people are like, oh, I don't know what to do. This person's different than me, and I'm offended. And it's like, maybe you should just look at IT, because we've already worked some of this stuff out.
Right.
There's already work environments with people who are not just multicultural, but to the extreme.
Right.
And
right.
they get along enough that they can get the work done. And the key is to focus on legitimate progress instead of focusing on differences.
Right. And actually, you may have had this experience. Have you worked with remote work groups where you're round the clock support, where your work team is actually split up over multiple geographies, multiple cultures? I've done that, quite a bit of that, Reuters especially, where our team was based in Switzerland and in India and in New York.
So they're not just different cultures with a shared major culture, but they're just completely different cultures.
Yeah, we're time, space, we're geographically, so everything about it is totally different, and yet got to get along. We got to get the job done. We got to communicate somehow. Yeah.
Somehow, I don't know what you were worried about. So Matt was like telling me he was a little nervous about being on the show, that he wasn't going to be as interesting as the other guests.
But
look at that point you just brought up. You just took what I did and just lapped it and next leveled it. And I'm like, well, I don't even know what to do with that now. I didn't think about that ahead of time.
Well, I looked at your list of guests you had. I mean, look who you just had last week, right? Ariella, and you had Steve May. You had Paul Trapani. You've got all these heavy hitters. Even our friend from Lilac, who was one of your first guests, Lee. So, you know, I mean, me against some of the people you've had, I mean, you got some pretty good. I hope your ratings didn't go down, by the way,
That may have happened, but it probably wouldn't have been you. It probably would have been the interruption or the lateness. But that's okay.
Right.
You know what? It's fine. It's the internet. It'll be there forever. So,
true.
You know, there are going to be people who have time to make a 3-hour window whenever they want. But,
right.
You know, I can't. Personally, I understand if you can't do that, because I can't do that.
Mm.
I can't listen live to live broadcasts that are 3 hours long when they come out very often.
Right.
Once in a while,
baseball games, which are becoming longer and longer all the time, it's difficult to.
You know, once in a while, yeah, but I mean, like, I plan my work around it. So
yeah.
I'll say, okay, this is a 3-hour. I'll actually look how long it is and say, okay, I need a 3-hour window. I have a 4-hour task here. I'll play that while I'm doing this task in the background and listen to it. So it's just impossible.
Right.
But you know, the thing that's important here is these are campfire stories. This is a campfire. It's in our blood, people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, you want to hear oral tradition is part of our, is part of our,
right.
And which is a ton to do with religion, but it also has to do with understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, a lot of just oral tradition is just about conceptual learning, and you can't do that without the time to, you know, explore the concepts and compare it and contrast it. And, you know, we had some discussions in the early shows about whether metaphors are good or bad. I don't know if you have an opinion on that or if they're worth it.
I guess they're...
If they have more risks or if they're more rewards.
I think they're more helpful than not, but we have to be careful about how we use them, right?
Yeah. Right.
Same thing goes for analogies.
You could definitely... Or analogies, right?
Yeah, analogies are very... You know, they're really meant to be a bridge to concepts that are very difficult for us to grasp, you know, but
right.
Choose them carefully.
It's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
Well, I think conspiracy theories are good for you, but the thing is, you have to remember it's a theory.
Right.
You know, okay, this is just a theory. I can't prove it. I can't revolve my life around this.
Right.
You know, that's when destructiveness happens, and I think a lot of the censorship is focusing around attacking conspiracy theories, and you know. Okay, I can understand if somebody's taking it literally and they're certain it's true and there's really limited evidence or no evidence that it's true, but like the theory itself is good for you. Sometimes people are plotting against you.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think you have to, we talk about, you know, taking the other
side. And it's even good for you sometimes when people plot against you.
Well,
In limited amounts, right? As sport as opposed to as maniacal, you know, civilization shattering.
I mean, real good debates are based on that, right? I mean, that's the basis of quality debates, is, you know, being able to take a side and be able to withstand attacks and come up with a counter argument. But you go back to we talked about the moon landing, several hours ago.
Yeah.
And
a long time ago,
yes.
in a faraway part of the podcast,
that's right,
we talked about the moon landing. Yes.
But 50 years ago. But you know, we believe it happened. But we have to understand why are there people who thought that this might be contrived? You know, what was the motivation behind them to think about that this could be something, you know? And there's always that thud out there, but what's the, you know, when you get to the real intelligent people who are thinking, you know, this moon landing didn't happen, you know, understand their motivation. Why wouldn't you think this is a...
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough. It's tough to, you want to nurture, right? You want to, like, if you're a steward of society, if you're a steward of civilization, right? You know, that's a concept that spans across faiths and also, across civics, right? You know, being a good steward, you know? And if you're a steward, you wanna foster an idea of inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what engages people, and that's what, like, makes them invest time and energy into into faith.
Mm-hmm. Cooperation, yeah. Or...
You can just pick my monologue right up. That was good. That's exactly the word
I'll take the Matt N role for 2 minutes, and this is Matt F.
I've been driving the government crazy with this stuff.
This is why this is called the conspiracy of Matt tonight, by the way.
There's no psychic link. Astrologists looking through the papers, you know. Where do they hear my dates? So I think I need a drink after that. I may have flipped through in one too many levels of Inception, and I'm trapped in the dream now. I don't know what the heck I was saying. We were talking about being stewards of society.
Stewards of society, yes.
Yeah.
And we do have to encourage everybody to work together, because that one person you've excluded may have the solution to your problem too, by the way.
Right, right. Remember that. Like, yeah. I love the Peter Jackson story, as far as, like, you know, like talking about, you know, if there's any question whether, you know, people in the movie business are technocrats, maybe not. It's possible maybe there are people who are in the movie business who aren't technocrats, but Peter Jackson's a technocrat, right? There's a guy who was a movie critic who turned into a director,
right?
You know, because he was so critical,
right?
And I mean, of course, that can go too far too, right? You know, Lord of the Rings, in my opinion, is better than The Hobbit, right? You know, so you can go too far with that too. But what?
Just your opinion?
Yeah. Okay. I don't need to make enemies of everyone in this one podcast. I can save that for future ones. But, you know, but I mean, clearly this is a guy who was just a fan, and it was so much more than that.
Yes,
and by his society being good stewards, it gave him the opportunity to become more.
Right.
And there's a million Peter Jacksons out there just waiting for nobody, you know, for some social media company, tech giant, to withhold the ban hammer.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yes, and give them a chance to follow their conclusions to the logical end. Now, of course, for every one of those, there's also a crank who's just never going to learn anything. He's just too stupid to understand.
Right.
You know, I mean, that happens. Yeah. I mean, this is, we have to leave a space for them too. I think intelligence, most of my moral kindness imperatives revolve around intelligence. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be, you know, top end of the IQ curve intelligence. Just, you know, smarter than a monkey, you know, intelligence, right?
Smarter than the average.
Smarter than average. Right? Yeah. So, if you can look at anybody's children and they're lower on the curve, like, you know, what is a 3-year-old the same as a grown chimp or a 4-year-old in reasoning ability? Like, all the different stats move differently as the human gets older.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can't just abandon people because they're behind the curve.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, at some point also, we can't have people who are running democracy who can't understand what the heck they're running.
Well, that, yes.
The argument the censors are using. Like, they'll never get it. Right. I mean, they don't know they're using it. You know, when you confront them with it, they're horrified. Mm. But, like, well, that's what you were arguing, whether you would do it or not.
Yes, yes.
That democracy is just beyond them, right? Which is a little ridiculous.
Right. I think of those who, you know, we talk about people who having the knack, but then there are those who have the knack, but because of their economic, socioeconomic condition, don't have the opportunity to build on that, right?
Well, that's almost the premise of STEM, right?
Yes.
Yes. Right. You just had the opportunity. If they had more exposure.
Right.
They had the exposure that they would get home if their mom or their dad was a tech, you know, or that, you know, like they had that time and that money and that energy and that space. Mm. And, I mean, I'm not against that because I think it's true sometimes, but I think, like most things of people, you know, just because it's true sometimes, it's also untrue sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get diminishing returns, too, you know?
Right.
What's the real cost of putting all the kids through a ringer, trying to get them to understand a technological way of thinking that they're never going to understand?
You know, and
you could have had them become better masters of the basics, and maybe their brains mature later.
Right.
When they're 25, they go, oh, I get it. Mm. But it's too late because you just spent all the time you could have just given them basic skills, pounding their brain into something that they're not going to ever get at that age.
Right, right.
You know, people develop differently.
Right. Well, now, we're both parents, right? So do you think how we've raised
our
children...
And my kids are geeks.
Yes, yes. See, well, and mine sort of are, right? So their education has been influenced not only by the time period that they're growing up in. I believe my children are a little bit older than yours. Mine are in their 20s.
Right.
So
mine are still kids, but they're getting older.
Yes,
they're both at least my younger one's at the age of reason, my older one's at the age of I am Groot. I am Groot. You know.
Oh, great.
Well, actually, he's just passed. He's now is I am Groot. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think the way that our kids were raised in my family, you know, had a great impact based on from what I went through. I remember my older son, same name as me, showing him Linux when he was 3 years old.
Wait, there's more mats.
There are more mats.
laughing yeah. back there. Like, how many mats are there? It's crazy.
My father was Matt also. So yes. We have a conspiracy in our own family.
Me and my friend, we this guy called Steven the Nazis, and our goal is to get the entire crowd just filled with Steve.
Really?
That's great.
That's great. Our name is Steve.
Well, at that point, you would technically be a culture, so you could say they were discriminating against Steve.
Yes. So we have to be careful. There's probably a law against that.
Culture and educated individuals.
What happens when people start hacking cultural identity?
But I do know that exposing our children to technology was very important, and so I have a picture of my son sitting at a it was 1995, and he was sitting at a Linux machine, mm-hmm. and so did my younger son. Now they use computers quite adeptly, like the rest of their generation. Neither of them has a job in computer science, but they are completely adept at using computers.
And I bet that's a major advantage in whatever their fields are.
Yeah, well, my older son is a music director. He's a director. He works at a community theater in Oakdale, and he's a very creative person. But he uses technology to the extreme in putting together the pit orchestra that he conducts and the music that he does. And it's very kind of neat to see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's cool.
That's good. And my younger son is now an assistant superintendent at a golf course in New Jersey. Also needs to understand technology because of all the equipment that is used to run a golf course, So
right.
So they're not, they're not afraid of it at all, and they got through science. I will say my younger son passed chemistry in college. It was the last class he had to pass. He passed it and got his Bachelor of Science. And my wife said, you will be the one to get him through his science through high school and college. It was a ball for me because I had a chance to do, to do chemistry with him,
right.
and help him. But
you had to get old Heisenberg.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about. You've seen him.
Yes.
Breaking Bad, people. If you haven't, do it.
But anyways, it was just very interesting the era that they grew up in versus, related to myself and where I came from. I just don't know if do you feel that you've exposed yourself to...
No, that's good. Don't worry. You weren't babbling. I could get in that vibe of you like, oh, no, it's babbling. No, you're totally not babbling. Yeah. So my kids are actually... They were a little further along. They were messing with tablets since they were, their first computer was at 3 and it was a tablet.
Mm.
That's how, people have been warning against that kind of level of immersion in technology. Yeah. And honestly, their grades are good.
Yeah.
They're for the most part, they're respectful, intelligent. They're both very intelligent,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of obsessed with video games right now,
uh-huh.
but it kind of makes sense.
Yes, yes.
But the thing is, the thing that's interesting is they're interested in not just video games, but also in modding. Now, part of this is me, mm-hmm. so...
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Right, so I would...
Is that a genetic thing, or is that an environmental thing?
I don't know. Probably I'm like the worst science case for this, because I'm so geeked out. We had a Minecraft server, and it went, we played as a family a lot of times with some pretty heinous mods, like just piles and piles of mods, and the insanity that ensued is whatever, as multiple movie universes collided in the same server until it crashed, or we got, I got tired of them killing me. because I'm like, it's a cooperative thing. They're like, no, kill that!
Right, yeah, yes, you know. Right. This is fun.
But they're both heavily into modding now, mm-hmm. so it's teaching them programming concepts in a way that maybe they wouldn't have learned it any other way.
Right.
There's a thing called Sketch, which is like this app that they try to encourage kids to learn like basic programming concepts in. I mean, like my younger one, he just cut right through it. Mm-hmm. He thought it was boring pretty quickly, mm-hmm. because honestly, like the redstone stuff you can do in Minecraft is more interesting.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because it's heavier.
Right.
You can really get into that. So, but they both have been doing modding. And actually, on Roblox has this really pretty advanced 3D modeler, and And so my younger one now is getting into building his own 3D modeled characters and worlds. Mm. And I mean, I'm looking at this, and I have a friend of mine. I wish he would come on the show. I've been bugging him to come on the show. He's got a computer graphics degree.
Oh, nice.
And he's basically doing what he would do in his bachelor's degree on his own. And he's young.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and so, like, I mean, I don't know. Was that me because of the mods?
Mm.
Or was that him because of the knack? I don't know.
Right. Or a little bit of both, which is, you know, maybe a weasel way out of saying, you know, sometimes you have to have the right combination at the right time.
Right.
You know, but,
I mean, you know, like, so, I mean, like, they've learned some critical security lessons.
Yeah.
So this is good for everyone to learn also.
Yep.
Got to be careful where you go on websites because, you know, if they go to the wrong web, Minecraft didn't work for a couple months on one of their laptops. He had downloaded something heinous that messed with the graphics driver, and he didn't understand what it did, and Daddy had to go through and find it, and it wasn't quick. Uh-huh. It took me a couple of days to find the thing that was breaking his Minecraft.
Yeah.
Did you just reinstall Minecraft?
We tried that. It wasn't that easy. So it would run, but it would just crash, and it wouldn't crash intelligibly. There was no log message or anything about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, I found it. I just went through and I said, do you actually use this program? Do you use this program? Do you use this program?
Right.
And we went through it systematically, but when he saw how much work that was, how much work it was to scientifically go through and prune his computer of anything he didn't need.
Yeah.
And then he appreciated the context of how damaging it is when you just go to random sites, download random stuff, and cross your fingers, things will be better.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but that's like a concept of, like, you know, if I wasn't a geek, it might have taken him longer to learn that.
Mm.
If I wasn't a geek, he might never learn that because he has his own laptop.
Yeah.
So if he did that to the family computer, in a less technical family's, you know, we have one computer.
Now the whole family.
Dad might go, you're banned from the computer.
Yeah.
And that would be the solution. He wouldn't learn anything.
Right. Right.
So, you know. And in the case of that kid, I get the STEM push, right? Because if he's the same kid but with a different dad, you know, with a different family, you know, he may never get a chance to see how that works.
Right. Right.
So, good. Kid, which one? I don't know.
Yeah,
is it Mac or is it dad? Or both? You know.
Yeah. Right. That's a good point. And I think the other problem I was thinking about is that I think sometimes the public says, don't immerse your kids in technology because then that's all that they have, right? And when we were growing up, at least when I was growing up, we were taught only 2 hours of television or whatever it was. You can't, don't sit in front of the boob tube for, you know, such a long amount of time.
So, well, I think that's true.
Yeah.
that one's true. Yeah.
It's, right. It's television, right. It's okay. Yeah. It's okay to be, you know, writing Python programs. Just don't be watching too much Megilla Gorilla. You know, that's not a good
thing. At least with the video games, there's a feedback loop.
Yeah, there is.
I don't like Fortnite because I think Fortnite is too slow.
Uh-huh.
The feedback loop is too slow. You're not really learning anything. You know, the strategies can be complex, but it takes so long to develop them.
Mm.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just whining. Yeah, it's just a different kind of first-person shooter and gathering materials. It's like, this is Minecraft crap. You know, I'm competitive and cooperative. I don't have to do both in the same game. Come on, guys.
Right, right.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So, no, it's okay.
Ah, get off my lawn. In my day.
That's right. But I think we want to expose our children to technology and, as I was saying before, and the fine arts and everything else. And so that's why it's interesting that I look at my kids and say, well, they have, you know, great facility with computers. Maybe they're not programmers, but they certainly have no fear of technology. And one of them has a job working, you know, outside at a prestigious golf course, and the other is in a completely creative field of musical theater. So, you know, it's good.
Right.
You know, because we expose them to more than just, you know, sitting at a computer for 24 hours.
Did they have their own computers? Or
they did, yeah.
Nice.
Linux computers, too, of course.
Wow.
Yes,
wow. Yeah. See, in a way, you got further than me because I just gave them Windows because, frankly, yeah, I'm the support. You know what it is?
Yeah.
Most of when that decision was made, now there are no Windows, so now I'm like, I don't know if I want to, like, force them. You know, I offer.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't taken me up.
Right.
There's been nibbles, but they haven't taken me up on that. But I didn't want to, force them to use Linux because I wasn't there. I was working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, only pretty recently have I had more of a flexible work schedule.
Right, right.
But like I'm at work, so when it breaks, it's my wife home with them. She doesn't know Linux.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't. She knows of it. She knows how it works.
Right.
She's
heard
used
of this,
it before.
This user group that you belong to for 20
right,
some
right,
odd
right,
years.
Right.
She understands. Yes.
I mean, you know, and of course, this deeply upset me many, many years ago. I was like, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you running? And now it makes total sense because they're running Linux all the time. Mm-hmm. They're just doing it with very narrow user interfaces.
Right, right.
You know, they're using it on the DVR. I'm sure that's Linux. The TV's Linux.
Yep.
The car's Linux.
Yep.
You know, the router they're running through is Linux. The server they're running through is Linux. They don't know.
Right.
Probably the printer's running Linux. You know.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, then she of course she had to be different and run Apple right. on her phone, well, but you know, well, have an Apple phone, but
right.
you know.
Well, ultimately, both of our children ended up, they both have, you know, MacBooks because between stuff that they needed for school or creative pursuits or whatever it might be, you know, so that's what they have. So they don't actually have Linux machines anymore, but they know what
well,
it
they
is.
They probably have a huge advantage on those Mac machines,
yeah, they,
having
yes.
used the Linux back in the day.
Yeah, again, it's completely right.
They're probably running DCSL commands all over the place. DSCL commands all over the place.
Right. Uh-oh.
You know, and manipulating their registries in the back end. Like, yeah, look what I can do. Yeah, this is great.
Yeah.
So they probably know how the file structure works and how it all looks and
absolutely yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean that stuff can really like kill you
mm-hmm.
when you're especially if you're like on a creative streak and you're like you're being creative with your computer, you have your app, you're using it, but if you don't understand where it's storing the files and right. how your file structure looks,
yep.
and understand that if that one file, you know, if either the metadata that represents the header for that file or the data for that file on the disk gets corrupted or goes missing,
mm-hmm.
it's gone forever.
Right.
You know, that's one of the great things about live streaming. You know, the internet's our backup, right?
Yeah,
you
right,
know,
right.
nothing else, we've got some of it, right?
Yep, right. You know? But obviously backups.
But I have to understand
with,
that for right. that for that to be important to me.
Sure, right. And you're working with a machine, whether it's a toaster oven or whether it's a high-powered computer or whatever it is. You understand the you know that you've got a piece of technology. It has its limits. It's you know you have to be one with the with your machine and That's good.
So, actually, we had a question before. What was the question? Sorry to jump on you, man, but I think it was something about AI or...
You guys were talking about... I just want to give context of it. You guys were talking about AI and machine learning, and someone mentioned, isn't machine learning a facet of AI?
Okay, so actually, this goes right in with one of the things I wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So the quick answer is machine learning is... essentially, what you're doing is you're training a script using a data set or a program using a data set to make its own decisions.
Right.
You're teaching it either through trial and error. Definitely through trial and error at various levels, depending on which level you want.
Right.
It could be you could be having multiple programs. You can have one program creating new iterations of itself. It doesn't really matter what the mechanism of creating new programs is.
Right.
You're having a program that's essentially rewriting itself, but dumbly, just to get to the point where it can answer a question set correctly.
Right.
So it's question set oriented. That's what machine learning is.
Right.
And it can be a really complex program and a really complex question set,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't really understand anything about what's happening. It's just, it's almost like instinct if you were to compare it to the animal kingdom. You know, hot, cold, you know.
Right.
Couldn't you just compare a bunch of different, like, very different question sets to get to the point where it could start to understand what's going on around it?
You could theoretically, but the problem is I don't know. I guess the way to put it is the problem is the evolutionary, chaotic, Darwinistic aspect of it is missing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not that you couldn't expand the data set to include everything to, you know, one step at a time until it gets to a point where it is actually intelligent.
Mm.
It's that companies just have no financial incentive to do that.
Right. So
they write a program to do a thing. So yeah, you could use that mechanism, I guess, theoretically. If just it's like a million monkeys at typewriters, right? Eventually you get Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That's kind of what machine learning is. So theoretically, you could have a billion monkeys at Shakespeare and get Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. But you know. That's a billion monkeys. That's a lot of money and time.
Yes.
Isn't IBM on the way to do that, though? Because IBM has like their really advanced AI that they're building.
Well, and, I guess for the billion monkeys... Oh, now I'm going to fit a billion monkeys on the title slide.
So, for
the billion monkeys solution, right? It's not... So there's actually charts out there, if you look around, comparing computer processing cycles to human intelligence and roughly correlating when we'll get to the point where computing cycles are as fast as the human brain is. Mm-hmm. And we're actually past that point already. Mm-hmm. But I think for the billion monkeys solution to AI, it's not enough to pass the point where a computer could theoretically do the work of the human mind. Mm-hmm. You have to be 1, 2, 3 orders of magnitude more so you can go through the time aspect of that, how much processing power it would take. You have to do an evolution simulation where you go through the entire set of all possibilities to get to the point where you have an intelligent thing at the end of the machine learning cycle that actually... Mm. And the thing that's terrifying about it is that we wouldn't understand at all how it worked. I mean, we don't even understand how our machine learning programs work.
Right. Yeah.
So once it's more intelligent than us, our chances of stopping it are basically zero, and that's the singularity.
Yeah.
Right. Then when it just matters if we hard coded something into it. Be nice. You know.
Right.
No, be nice. Be a good robot. You know.
Right.
If we didn't do that, if it's not built into there, just keep saying that over and over, it might just be like, I'm sick of your crap.
Well, we remember HAL 9000 from the...
Right.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, I'm sick of you astronauts and your crap.
That's right, right.
Yeah. Sorry, I spoiled 2001 Space Odyssey, which was written in 68.
Yes.
Released in 68. Hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely past the month rule.
Yeah. it's good.
I hope that. What do you think? Was that a good explanation? Would you like to add anything to it?
Yeah. You know, I think that's pretty good. I always consider them to be very, very different from each other. And artificial intelligence, really, something that sort of is able to spawn its own thoughts or its own rational sort of, you know, figure things out, whereas the machine learning is very mechanical, right? It's, it's very, like you said, iterative, where it's building a set to still a known solution.
Yeah, I think machine learning will, if you run enough iterations and give it diverse enough data sets, eventually it will spawn legitimate intelligence. But the data sets are going to have to be so vast, and it's got to do it for so long.
Right.
I mean, just look at evolution. Just like, it's probably comparable. What are we, we might be looking at a billion years. From the first single cell, life to all the way up to human beings, you might be waiting that long. So yeah, sure, it's possible, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Right. It's
well, hopefully we'll be long gone and be like, oh look we left
doing
all those computers running.
Guess what
and
they're
they
doing.
Came to life and now they're following us through the universe as we since we exited from Earth.
Right.
For all we know, that's what's happening, and they're just waiting until we get sustainable space travel, and then
right. We've got them right.
Flapping behind you.
We've got them right.
I don't know. For some reason, I just make big bird noises. I don't know. Oh, no. It's the laptops. Run.
Right.
That would definitely be something straight out of Hitchhiker's Guide.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Okay. So what do you think about the singularity? Do you worry about it? I mean, aside from machine learning run amok and the astronomical odds, do you think someone's going to come up with a more bottom-up approach to AI and we're going to get a singularity?
You know, I always hesitate when I say, no, it can't be possible, because humans are pretty...
You only have to be wrong once, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Chicken little only has to be wrong once.
Yeah.
I mean, right once. Yeah.
And so, I wonder about that. And I say it's probably not going to happen. But then, am I being paranoid and being a conspiracy theorist myself in thinking that way? I don't know. I think...
Well, right. In a way, cognitive dissonance, which is like the insistence that everything is going to just continue the way it has and then everything's normal
right.
is a conspiracy theory in and of itself. Mm. It's like, oh, human beings can't make progress.
Right.
That's the conspiracy theory. It's yes. just another conspiracy theory. Yes. You are a conspiracy theorist. You have to be. Right. Either you're a cognitive dissonance conspiracy theorist or just a plain old conspiracy theorist. It's just a matter of how self-aware you are.
Right.
We got some tinfoil somewhere.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Tinfoil goes great with wine. It's good to be a technocrat.
Yes. That's the best part.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I mean, it's technocrats are not always evil.
No,
right?
Not always, no.
They could be evil. They right. could be good. It's kind of a neutral thing.
I think people who fear it, you know, who fear technocracy or fear, you know, just again, fearing technology, you know, are have that. That's where they're at. And for whatever reason,
you know, it's just a thought experiment with the Amish, with the Mennonites, you know, with the Amish specifically, because not all Mennonites are Amish, but,
right.
You know, they couldn't be who they are without having the technological military juggernaut that the United States is protecting them.
Yeah.
You know, people forget that. You know,
right.
it's like, oh, yeah, it'd be great to just be, go back to the country and, you know, yeah. do barn raisings. And, yeah, guys, there's computer simulations and nuclear weapons and stealth bombers protecting you.
Right, right.
You know, so, and the latest metallurgy and chemistry. Saving your butt from marauding pillagers.
Right, and then total annihilation. And yeah.
Total annihilation. And, you know, and bless them. Because, you know, it's like they got lucky, right? You know, they rolled the dice, you know, snake eyes. Yeah, perfect. Right, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not a good life plan, you know.
Right.
Could say it was divine intervention, but there's still other vehicles at
yeah.
work.
Yes.
Protecting them.
Very,
so
very
they're not alone.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And the Amish are actually very good at the technology that they use, right? I
mean, right. Oh, they totally, the technologies they have access to, they mastered.
Yes.
Right. Right. But, and it's interesting when you think about that and, you know, joke around about how people, if you take people from 100 years ago and bring them now, they would be technocrats. They just wouldn't be technocrats in things that we value.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. They might be master woodworkers,
right.
and we'd awe at the rocking chair that they could build.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Right.
Or the, you know, like, wow, that is the most efficient steam engine. That is the best steam engine restore I've ever seen.
Right. Now
right?
step aside, dude, as I create that on my 3D printer.
That's a phenomenal 50 horsepower, you know, 150 foot-pound of torque engine that you've built. You know, I'm really impressed, you know.
Right.
Then you hop in your Celica and you you're tuned Celica and you burn the rubber down to the rims and on your way home, you know.
Right, right.
So, I don't know who tunes a Celica. I just, yeah, for some reason I felt like picking on Toyota people. Well, you know, this is, so it's like a friend of mine had a low-end 80s Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the lowest Porsche they sold at the time. It's a 944. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it said Porsche, so it was like, oh, it's a Porsche.
Right.
But it was so slow that a base stock Ford Focus from... could beat it. And it's like, okay, I think it's lost its luster for me. I don't care anymore. If I could just go and get the cheapest beater I could find in the lot,
right?
You know, and beat it, it's not impressive anymore. Okay, so I think, one thing I wanted to ask you about digital rights management, do you have any nightmare stories or any, I mean, I know you probably don't like it, because it's just not like an open source person to like being controlled on their hardware, but, you know, do you have anything that you wanted to mention or talk about digital rights management?
I was thinking about it in terms of the music industry, music business, right? And so you have the musicians who, not classical musicians, but the ones who follow the old-fashioned model of rights management to their recordings and their whatever their properties are,
mm-hmm.
And then you have musicians in the new era who are much more likely to create and share what they have. And so I wonder about that. Is digital rights management restricting creativity? Is it, you know, because to me, DRM is definitely evil, right?
It just seems like despite it being defeated, you know, unequivocally over and over and over, and demonstrating huge problems, we keep coming back to it, and I just don't understand.
Right.
To me, that's the evidence that we really need to fix the artistic copyright model.
Right, right.
That we even would consider going back to it.
Right, because as soon as somebody devises the next unbeatable DRM, we know that there's some hackers about 10 yards behind them who are going to...
Well, tech is just a huge pile of arms races.
Yes.
That's what a lot of people don't understand about, you know, technologies. And almost everything is an arms race.
Right, it is.
You know, there are some
security.
Unsolved problems, but for the most part, problems are solved and everybody's trying to come up with a better solution constantly and succeeding.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of work to be done still. Some of the examples that I can come up with easily, like, you know, lock-ins, you know, do harm to consumers. You know, they waste your ability to plan your own, to replenish your printer, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, you have Deadpools like the Microsoft Zune.
Mm.
You know, where you have all this money and time invested in
so much potential.
Right, and then it's just wasted.
Right.
Right. You know, and you know, DVD regions where people are punished for where they live. You know, based on, you know, economic models that really have nothing to do with any kind of merit whatsoever.
Right.
You know.
Just solely, right.
You know, or even necessarily need, right? I mean, because if you're a wealthy person in one of those areas, it barely affects you. You're living, you know, it's almost inspiration to retire to a different region, you know, so you can get your DVDs and your music cheaper.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
But, you know, so I guess it's an economic incentive that way. But, you know, I just was wondering if you had any other input on that.
Yeah, I was trying to just think of any particular, like, you know, war stories or issues with that. And I guess, you know, I've never been a person like a pirater. I always believed in at least trying to follow the rules.
Do you buy CDs?
I do buy CDs.
I buy CDs too.
Yes, I do. And I
Technocrat Live almost entirely buys CDs.
And I want to support musicians who create music and that. So, but I guess it's when things become restrictive, and when we have property that we've purchased, like if I've purchased a CD, I should have the right to create MP3s of it so that I can listen to it in a variety of places. I'm not looking to try to give it to my friend.
One of the things with the clear cut case, one of the things we got into conversation, Steve and I, and I brought it up too, you know, unusual or exotic CDs.
Mm.
I mean, if there was ever a clear case where you really should be able to rip your own music,
right,
and put the CD on a shelf and forget it, because you don't want to lose that, because it's not just that, you know, it's irreplaceable,
right,
or closer, or you know, at least very expensive to replace.
Right, right. You know? So that's why you're,
you know,
right,
like all those movies sitting in a vault, just rotting, because no one can afford to buy them. You know, they're literally hostages of the copyright system, and those movies are gonna die. And sure, some of them are probably garbage, but I'm sure there's stuff in there that's important for humans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and pop culture even, you know, this is something I think that we're overdue for a backlash in pop culture because it's been owned for so long. There's so many. I know everyone I know. Part of their identity is made up by the 70s or the 80s or the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You
right,
know,
right.
Because those were all eras where before music sharing or movie sharing or show sharing became a real thing.
Yeah.
And they can't exercise that. You know, I couldn't put a clip of an appropriate song, it's not really, this format's not really appropriate for it, but almost every other format is.
Yeah.
Especially if you have an edited format, you know.
Right.
And, you know, the copyright takedowns are getting so vicious, and it's like, but this is part of my culture, this is part of who I am.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, it seems like the younger generations are kind of getting away from even accepting pop culture, and I don't think it's all bad.
Right.
Having a shared reference point isn't always bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're losing.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. So like you said, you know, artistic licensing, that's really where the key has to be, and not in these restrictive technologies, which are really just...
Right. Yeah. I mean, in a way, maybe that's what we're seeing, right? You know, we have people arguing about not having a shared culture, you know, and getting at odds with each other, becoming hyper-offended, you know? It's because they don't have a shared culture, because pop culture is getting thrown under the bus, you know, and people are just abandoning it because they just it's not practical to have it anymore. You know, so I mean, you know, and I'm all for diversity in culture and having lots of little subcultures with, you know, I like these kinds of music, and you know, there's a thousand different kinds of little kinds of genres of music that people tend to stick to their genres, but you know, they're not melting into each other and flowing like they used to.
That's true.
It seems like it's all disincentives for pop culture, for shared culture. You know, pop culture is a commercialized shared culture, but let's just say shared culture, and it can include pop culture as a positive.
That's a good point.
I just had a couple more things. First of all, is there anything you wanted to talk about?
We hit on it a little bit before, but you know, the user group concept. That's our our shared experience in life of being part of this user group, right?
Right.
And how do we, you know, because user groups tend to be formed around some kind of technology, some excited shared kind of a commonality, whether it's photography or Linux or whatever it might be.
Right.
And is the
bird watching?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. No. Seriously.
You're actually right. So is the user group concept dying, or is it still important? Is it still alive? Right. So.
I wonder. So we have two competing forces. One is this kind of compartmentalization where people are just focusing on subcultures more and more and more, and the common. The shared culture is kind of withering because the law is structurally forcing it to, you know. But also, you have people. I don't know. I'm trying to think of the best way to put it. When you have people don't necessarily want to meet in a physical space. Also,
that's a right.
We're seeing it. We're seeing a lack of young people, and I don't know if it's because they're so afraid of maybe it's because they don't have the skills to acclimate into new cultures.
Right.
You know, because that's preventing them from even trying.
Right.
Like they're afraid they're going to blow it.
Right.
And that's completely wrong. You know, I mean, there's some very basic rules. Just don't be rude to anybody.
Right.
Give people the benefit of the doubt. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Right.
You know, and if you, you know, in that order, because I think the golden rule can be a trap. Right. Because you can imagine. When you have no experience with something, you can imagine it being one way, and it's actually another. So you know, if the golden rule is foundation is basically purely an imagination, it doesn't work anymore.
It needs to have
experience in there too.
It does. Yeah.
And that's one of the things with the broken common culture.
Right. I think also comes.
But
to
we better fix it because I think the solution. I think part of this is government corruption. So I think one of the things that's happening is the government corruption is creating the problems with the copyright and creating the problems with the common shared culture, which we're kind of being solved. Like, we'll solve it a little, and then somebody will get freaked out and sound an alarm, and it's like, but no, we were just solving this problem. Like, I guess they don't recognize shared culture as a problem. I don't know. Do you see people like that? Do you think that they're recognizing shared culture as a problem? Do you see it as a problem, like a lack of ability to participate in shared culture?
I think so, and I think part of that is unfortunately due to the political climate that we live in, right? I think there's a lot of you know, either you're on this side or that side, and again we won't talk politics, but just in general, and it
doesn't matter what the two sides are. They can change.
Right? Yeah,
they can change like that.
It's right. So
9/11.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like that.
Sure.
So that's changed.
I think there's that. And we mentioned young people too. I think it's hard to put yourself in the mind of a young person. Myself being an old person now, being a dinosaur. But I know there's a lot of.
I'm not dead yet.
That's right.
Monty Python.
Excellent.
Life of Brian.
I think that when we look at what young people consider interesting, sometimes the interest span is 5 minutes, right? 10 minutes, whatever. It's very difficult when you have a user group that wants to get together in a physical location and talk about something for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. Is that beyond the scope of what a younger person might imagine as doable? It's like, oh no, I can do this remotely. I can do five things at once, and it's only going to hold my interest for 5 minutes anyway. So you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, so I can get into the conspiracy theory space a little bit here. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just a theory.
Okay.
But I mean, it's very suspicious the way that there's so much emphasis on de-emphasizing common culture mm-hmm. and shared culture, integration, essentially, where people are trying to find a middle ground where everybody can get along. Mm-hmm. You know, like whether it's in your teleconference, they have to do it for business.
Right.
But, you know, like, or the business fails. Uh-huh. But, like, you know, also in their leisure time, too. And I think that finding the common ground between people, you know, whether it's just as simple as the color of your blood or the air that you breathe, uh-huh. Or if it's something much, much broader or deeper. Mm-hmm. Because corruption, it's been my experience, and I think that history shows that corruption is stronger in larger organizations and older organizations. Mm-hmm. That organizations, you know, there's this concept that was part of the founding of the country, and I think that they were correct, and unfortunately there's no way to do really hard science on it, but I think it's pretty obvious that old political structures become corrupt over time. Mm-hmm. And it may not happen, it can happen at different rates of speed, you could say one's better than another, but they all eventually become corrupt and eventually risk collapse.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're reformed and then start over on their own, or whether they collapse and then reform.
Right, they don't evolve.
Right. Eventually, governments die.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
So, and I think that actually this is a solvable problem. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that most people don't even think that that's a problem in the first place, so no one's trying to solve it.
Uh-huh.
So, if it is a solvable problem, the solvable problem is in the sense that governments can, by moving government operations more locally, you make it more likely to see the corruption because you're closer to it.
Right, you're right. You're not in a
the less degrees of separation there are. Yeah. You know, the idea of degrees of separation, like how many people you need, does the game of telephone need to go through? Right. The more people it needs to go through, the more likely there is, the easier it is for corruption to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
So the solution to decorrupting government. And I think it's possible to decorrupt it. You don't have to wait till it dies. You can actually fix it.
Right.
You can make it healthy.
The
you can play doctor. You don't have to let it die. And I think they're right about that.
Yeah.
But they're wrong that it's just going to happen on its own. Mm. And they're wrong to think that further centralization is going to fix it. I think you need to go local.
Yeah.
And the key to going local is the user group.
Right.
So I can coming around full circle.
Yeah,
so,
no, that's an excellent point. Yeah.
You know, so like I'm like, why is there so much emphasis on, you know, everyone defending their own, all their one or three or dozen or eight dozen subcultures? Mm-hmm. I'd rather see them trying to get along with everybody, because that at least locally. I mean, locally is easy, right?
Right.
You know, you meet people. I mean, I wonder how much dating apps has to do with that. You know,
yeah.
Right? You know, right. you have a list, and then you know some geek somewhere decides how that list applies and applies it to someone else, and you theoretically match them or don't.
Yes. Yeah. That's cool. But I like that. I like the fact that we can. I agree with you. We can see the user group being an important. Still an important structure, and it was different 20 years ago when we formed LILOG. We were
on beepers then.
We were days
and when LILOG formed.
We had the problems that we were trying to solve were, you know, introducing people to Linux, getting your can you believe we were trying to help people install this thing from floppies, and also to
Yes.
Slackware. Yes. And also to get them to get an ex Windows system going to be able to see graphics. These were hard problems to solve back then, right? Those
right.
are the problems that we were trying to solve back then. Now we've gotten past that. So what are the new problems that we have to solve? Perhaps these are more organic problems of just cooperative.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then back in those days, we were on the Web 1.0 days.
Yes.
And Web 1.5 was just like a twinkling in our eye. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the first time someone told me about network address translation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think it was in the Linux user group, and I'm like, what? You could do that? That's internet sharing, which everybody uses whether you know it or not now.
Yes, right.
You only have one IP address for your house on the big internet, and all those IPs in your house are fake, and that's network address translation. That was new back then.
Yeah.
That's an example of a Web 1.5 where you're kind of glomming on this one add-on to the one server idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we really have to figure out how to fix the user group. We figure out how to fix the user group. We figure out how to fix the local problem, and we figure out how to fix the big government problem. And
life's good.
Yeah, if you can get a group of people to meet and to integrate and to socialize and to get along, that's it, right? All problems, start small. You don't have to fix everything at once.
Right.
Just fix the people nearby.
Right.
Right.
That's great. And on top of that, I think that the user group was, and this is my experience, was an excellent opportunity for those that have knowledge to not silo, to be able to share it with others. So, being able to, we've had, just about every, meeting that we would have and continue
Very
to
good
have,
point.
Right, is that somebody would get up, whether it's a lightning talk, right, somebody talks for 5 or 10 minutes on a very, whatever topic or...
You can totally get the format of the show.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to the... Every man, you're speaking to the technocrat. You're saying, hey, dude, eventually your DevOps model is going to get flushed down the toilet unless you fix this.
Right.
The cancer will keep spreading, and you get to the point where people can't even stop, help but silo.
Right, right.
Because everyone's all closed off in their little quarter.
Right.
This is my fiefdom. I own this data.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
How is it ridiculous?
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Right. So,
Matt, thank you so much. Believe it or not, we're out of time.
No way.
Yeah. So, everyone, Matt Tirico, thank you for tolerating our troubles and coming by and seeing us. And I'll be back here next week.
Great.
And again, Matt Tirico, thank you again.
Thank you very much. And I wish you
can great you
success.
With you.
I can't believe it's over. It means I got to go back home now.
Yeah. Well, will we come on again?
Oh, good. I will come on again. Yes. Perhaps a panel.
And then we can finish this list. I told you.
He's got a lot of notes there, folks, I tell you.
Yeah, we could do this. I could do this all day.
Oh, wow. And you do an excellent job at it. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you so much.
Yes, yeah. All right, man.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. See you next week.